2018 was the beginning. From podcasts to live events, Fight Night Picks was off and running.
Do you typically train for a fight with a specific game plan in mind, or do you train for a certain opponent?
Honest to God, I always have the same game plan.
A year later, a new ad.
The cringe fest continues with Henry Cejudo. He pulled out a snake today. Old clip.
Since then, it's been a wild ride. 2022 shaping up to be another crazy year.
Hurt Chandler. He might be peacocking right now. I think that left hook hurt.
Whoa! Peacock right hands, Michael Chandler!
Oh, they've both been hurt this
time. Oh!
So as they say, let's get into it.
Welcome back with Fight Night Picks. We've got a big time Fight Night card coming up this weekend. Listen, King Bobby Green, he is back and he has all of the hotness. You asked for it, you get it. He's going to be one half of your main event, taking on a top five ranked future champion, some would say, Islam Makhachev, but I'm really looking forward to it. All over this card, it's loaded with prospects. We have four UFC debuts. Some would call it a Fight Night Picks special, and as always, one half of your hosting duo with Fight Night Picks, Craig Allen. You can find me on the socials at Craig Allen FNP. Make it very simple. Matt Allen with the contrasting sweaters in color. We have Matt Allen at Matt Allen FNP. So at Matt Allen FNP, Carlos Hernandez, Victor Altamirano. We've got Ramona Pascual. We've got some big time heavy hitters in their UFC debuts. And I think this is one of those cards that if you had a friend that might not be into MMA, you can kind of get them in on the ground floor of some of these fighters, because apart from the debuts, we only have two ranked fighters. We have Armin Zarukian and Islam Makhachev in the same division. So it's one of the weaker cards on paper, name value-wise, but these are typically the cards that deliver, just like we had last weekend.
And the great thing about this card, and it's something I think we can both agree on, is that the matchmaking is quite competitive. Although the names might not be household names, I still think a lot of these matchups are very closely contested all the way up the card. Even though there isn't a lot of ranked fighters, and isn't it awful too? This is why I might not give a first-time UFC viewer this card, because there is only two ranked fighters on here, and I wouldn't say either ranked fighter is known for their entertainment value necessarily between Armin Zarukian and Islam Makhachev. Listen, we enjoy their fights. People who like our videos probably enjoy their fights, but I would say to the wider audience, it's probably a little bit harder to get them involved to a Armin Zarukian co-main event, but I really do think this is going to be a really fun card to watch top to bottom.
I brought you in up here, Matt brought you down there. We're going to throw it to the fight of the night screen, and there's one fight that did make the fight of the night screen, so breaking the fourth wall with Fight Night Picks. We have a hard time choosing them sometimes. It's pretty easy this week, but I will say, I'll sprinkle in Terrence McKinney, Farah Ziem. What a fight. I can't wait for that one. But we'll throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen. As always, presented by, well, it could be you. You could sponsor the Fight of the Night screen. Hit us up on the socials. You can find us at Fight Night Picks as well. Let's throw it on over to there.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
So Rung Zhu is going to be taking on Ignacio Bahamondes. This is lightweight action. And for Ignacio Bahamondes, one of the bigger guys you're going to find at lightweight, does he do like the double take the Spider-Man meme when he sees Joel Alvarez this week? I don't know, but both guys at 6'3". And for Ignacio Bahamondes, you buy low in the UFC debut, while most people bought high, myself included. He was a big favorite against John McDessie. He was coming off of an old man knee injury. Cool. And really, John just turned back the clock in that performance. So kudos to him. But for Ignacio, comes back, has a knockout of the year caliber knockout over Roosevelt Roberts. And you look at it for Rong Zhu, you buy high on him at the same time, making his UFC debut against Kazula Vargas. He was a decent-sized favorite. I was very high on the fighter out of China. Really, Kazula Vargas did something we didn't often see. He went strike for strike. He threw good volume. He was mainly known as a power puncher. So Rong Zhu comes out as next time. He's originally scheduled to take on Dakota Bush. He gets Brandon Jenkins. And in that fight, he just about knocked him dead in the first round and really put together a well-rounded game plan. That's why I like this fight, because from distance, one guy has success. From close range, the other guy has success. When they mix it up, I think this has all of the makings for a fight of the night here.
If the saying "you're only as good as your last performance" holds true, then oh my god, we are in for a treat. Because Ignacio Bahamondes, I know we got rewarded with a bonus against Roosevelt Roberts. We needed to reward him with something extra his next time out, because oh my goodness, that's one of the greatest knockouts you will ever see. Did a lot of research for this fight card, as we often do getting ready for these videos. But I just kept on hitting like 15 second rewind on that KO, cause it was a thing of beauty. But like you said, Rong Zhu didn't have the best UFC debut, but showed promise. And that's really all you can ask for a lot of people coming in. We don't always look at the wins and losses and consider them. Sometimes it matters how you looked in a loss. Sometimes it matters how you looked in a win. Rong Zhu looked great his last time out. And I think that if we do get the best version of Rong Zhu and of Ignacio Bahamondes, we're in for an absolute treat this weekend.
And when you look at our second pick, I mean, Alejandro Perez won season one of The Ultimate Fighter Latin America back in 2014. Headlining was Cain Velasquez. I mean, it was UFC 180 at the time. And listen, Velasquez had his guy, Alejandro Perez, and he continued to make moves over with American Kickboxing Academy. This is a guy with a stellar record in the UFC. His only losses are to Song Yadong and Cody Stamen. He's taking on Jonathan Martinez, a guy who Matt thought could be a future champ different divisions.
Top 15, Craig.
However, for Jonathan Martinez, this is a guy that's kind of taken his lumps. He loses his debut against Andre Sukumtat. He was the most timid man on the face of the earth in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, close to the hometown of the boys. But when it's come to his other performances, save for the Davey Grant fight, because he was a little reserved and then he started to put his punches together and then Davey just threw the old right hand, left hand knock him out. But for Jonathan Martinez, I think he brings a fire to this fight against Perez, a guy who is well-rounded, but loves to power punch and throw in the pocket.
And that's why I think this is going to be a fight of the night. It's a very important fight for both guys' careers. Jonathan Martinez was a hyped-up prospect, suffered a few losses, and this is sort of make or break at this point. And against Alejandro Perez, some say Lady Gaga wrote a song about him. Not at all. But for Perez, he was a top 15 fighter. He did have quite a bit of promise in his career, but we've seen him stumble as of late. If you just look at his last three fights, he is only 1-2, and even his one win isn't against the greatest fighter of all time in Johnny Eduardo at this stage of his career. So for Perez, he really needs a win, because if he loses this one, being 1-3 in your last four and being the age that he is, it's not a great position to be at in the bantamweight division. And for Martinez, you can only lose so many times until you get thrown into that Eric Silva prospect category, so Martinez definitely needs a win, but these guys both come to throw hands, and I think it'll be a great fight.
J-Mart coming in at 27, looking to make moves after he beat Zviad Lazishvili his last time out for Perez, the big win over a guy whose age I don't know. I don't think the world knows. Johnny Eduardo, man of the people, but a big-time fight coming up this weekend nonetheless. So when it comes to not just this weekend's card, but the last three, I stumbled out of the gates the first two. I had a horrid showing, and then I came back like a phoenix rising the last two, and then last weekend, both of us going 8-4. A lot of people out there in the comments section, though, went 9-3, so pat yourselves on the back. Good job for you guys out there in the comments section. Doing the damn thing every single week. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have fight over fight. There's guys like Akash Deep there every week. There's Dave Baker, who's out there every week. A lot of people out there in the community having a great time, making friends. So let us know down below who you have in some of these fights. It should be a big week. We got a slate of 12 fights, and as you know, if anything falls out, as we had last weekend, Mario Bautista, Khalid Taha, we hopped in with the old Jay Perrin video as quick as possible. We'll do that as best we can this week. I have the week off this week, so maybe it'll be a little bit quicker than normal, but I am really looking forward to this card. And Matt, I have a lot to say about some of these prospects coming up.
I think it's going to be a really fun card. Again, it might not have the name value that some other Fight Night cards have, but the great thing is, and I think we talked about this a little bit on Question Mark Kicks, there's great fights on the horizon. We can see them. They're getting close. We're almost there. Really big pay-per-views coming up. Really great main events. It's just been really unfortunate that the last two main events have dropped out. We were supposed to have the Battle of Raphaels last weekend. This weekend, Islam Makhachev was supposed to finally get the toughest test in his career, because this is the thing, and I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later. If you beat Bobby Green, do you get a title shot after that? Probably not, exactly. But if you beat Benil Dariush, like, there's a real chance to get title shot after that. So it is unfortunate that Makhachev, there always seems to be an oh by the way every time he is afforded one of these 5-round opportunities. But I still think it's going to be a great main event.
Maybe King Bobby Green can go out there and get the win. Like
Frank Allen with Fight Night Picks. I realize they made a mistake. I'm going to make this mistake throughout the show. I'm going to call Adriano Martins, Adriano Moraes. You know, your one championship guy. No, Adriano Moraes, great current fighter. Adriano Martins, legendary former fighter. I make the mistake quite a few times. It's a disclaimer. Let's get into it.
Adriano Moraes, that remains to be seen, but a big-time fight card coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss any of it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Really interesting fight coming up this weekend. Flyweight Never Die. We have Victor Altamirano taking on Carlos Hernandez. A couple of flyweights that are getting the opportunity, having won their fights on Dana White's Contender Series this past season by split decision. That's something that we don't see very often. And for Victor, coming out of Mexico City, Mexico, training in Texas out of V-Fit, House of Champions. This is a guy who, even though he won the fight, his opponent, Candelario, also got a contract. That was the first contract handed out on Contender Series in, what, the five seasons of the show, where the loser actually got a shot. And in the first round, Candelario looked really good. In the second round, he slowed down. In the third round, he got beat fairly handily. And this is really where the nuts and the bolts of this fight really do matter. Because if you looked at it for Altamirano, I mean, listen, really, really sneaky fighter. He's on a tidy little four-fight win streak. And if you go back and you look at his last loss, it's against Jared Brooks, who was making his way back into the world after losing.
I just have to cut you off, Craig. Yeah. I'm sorry. No single person has suffered more when the UFC almost cut the flyweight division than Jared Brooks. Please hear me out. This guy lost a split decision to Deiveson Figueiredo. And I'm going to pull a Craig right now and say, lost a split decision. Because I got to be honest, I thought he beat Deiveson Figueiredo. You know, the guy who currently has the title, who just beat Brandon Moreno two times in three fights, or at least one and a half times, basically. Jared Brooks ends up losing his next time out to Shorty Torres, which was weird because he knocked himself out going for a takedown. Hashtag look into it, Eddie Bravo style. And the UFC gets rid of him because they believe they're going to give up the division. He hasn't lost a fight since. Now, currently he is under contract with one championship, so he has landed on his feet. It's not like it's ended all poorly for him. But oh my goodness, I get sad thinking about what could have been with Jared Brooks. A dominant wrestler who had really good cardio, decent stand-up. I just get really upset thinking about the fact that he was able to go tit for tat with a guy like Deiveson Figueiredo. Then he has sort of an embarrassing moment against Shorty Torres, and then we never hear about him again. Sorry, I'll give it back to you. I just had to get that out.
No, there's somebody in their car that's just banging the steering wheel because we went off topic, but I'm absolutely fine with it because it does help tell the story of the loss that Victor Altamirano has on his record. Because if you do go back and watch that, and if you factor in Jared Brooks' overall career arc, I mean, the guy was on a heater of a win streak.
He was so good.
Undefeated as an amateur, undefeated as a pro, loses to Figueiredo, loses to Shorty Torres, then goes out, beats Roberto Sanchez, has an accidental headbutt in Ryzen, so they, you know, it's a no contest on his record, beats Altamirano, beats Oshii in the rematch, and then he goes out and gets two wins over with one championship. Jared Brooks is a very good fighter, and when he fought Victor Altamirano, he goes out there, takes him down at 5 seconds of the first round, and holds him down for the entire first round. Then in the second round at 11 seconds, he catches a kick and takes him down, and then ends up finishing him. So for Victor, again, that's his only loss as a pro. As an amateur, pretty decent little career. I mean, he did go 4-3 as an amateur, but this guy has had an interesting run because all the way up into the Jared Brooks fight, I mean, he was what, 6-0, five of those wins by finish, but he hasn't really gotten a lot of finishes since. He does have one over Lloyd McKinney. That is a very, very good one. Lloyd McKinney is one of those guys in the regional scene that if you pay attention in the States, you know his name. Second round triangle choke win there. He then goes out and headlines LFA 100. The best part for Victor Altamirano, the craziest part of it is, you might not know this, in 2017 as an amateur, he was on the undercard of LFA 1. Then he headlines the main event of LFA 100. It's not often in North America you have flyweights that headline a card, but Victor Altamirano was able to go out there, do that, win the belt over there with LFA. A big win over Nate Smith, a guy who had some of the best wrestling credentials that we've really seen over with LFA. So a huge win for him there. I mean, a couple 50-45s, 149-46 in that fight. Goes out, fights Carlos Candelario. Split decision win for me. It might sound weird, but I actually scored that fight for Victor Altamirano. Again, I mentioned it. I thought he lost the first round. He won the second. He won the third. But again, we're going to kind of go both ways in this fight because I love these prospects and I want to really give them their due. Maybe if you missed out on some of the tape study, that's where we are. We're here to fill you in on these guys. The one thing that I love out of Victor Altamirano, it was in part of my notes, his Taekwondo is great. His takedown defense is not good, and he accepts bottom position, and I know he's got triangle choke wins, he's got a Darce choke wins, he loves the defensive submissions, but he gets held down for moments, and again, it does scare me. Not necessarily just against Jared Brooks, but against other fighters as well.
It'd be like if you're going to the grocery store with your mom as a kid, and you're saying, hey, can we get Tony Ferguson to the grocery store? And she says, no, we have Tony Ferguson at home. Well, Tony Ferguson at home is Victor Altamirano. Now, that might not be giving Tony Ferguson the respect he deserves. It definitely isn't. But Victor does kind of fight like a bare-bones version of Tony. He has very porous takedown defense because he does have a lot of belief in his own jiu-jitsu and really his bottom game overall. There's something we were talking about before we started filming this video where, if you look early on in his career, he does have a lot of success with his grappling, especially with his submission grappling, going for submissions, getting sweeps, sort of those bigger actions off of your back. But when he does start to fight the better wrestlers, he still has those tendencies where it's like, okay, I can give up this takedown because I'm a good grappler. But against Nate Smith, for instance, who, I gotta be honest, I don't think all that highly of Nate Smith. His stand-up is very, very basic. You can see that in that fight. But he is a good wrestler. Smith was able to just hold Victor down for long portions of that fight. And he wasn't all that active in the top position, which isn't great. It sort of speaks to Nate Smith as an opponent. But if Victor is in there with a more active guy in that top position, a guy, I know he doesn't fight in the weight class, but like Cody Stamann comes to mind. Like Cody Stamann would just lay on top of him for 5 minutes every single round and win like a 30-20 decision. That's how one-sided it would be. But with Altamirano, I really like his striking. He has great long-distance strikes, and he's really good at throwing 1-2 combinations with his hands and then mixing in his kick. And he has a great kick to the body and great kick to the leg, too. He's a tricky southpaw with that respect, and it's something that his opponents really do have to watch out for.
That's one other thing. I just have a couple more notes before we focus on Carlos Hernandez. I have him listed as a switch fighter. The UFC went that way, too. He will rarely ever go to the orthodox stance just to give a different look, switch back over to the southpaw, but he is mostly a southpaw fighter. You brought it up, the kicks. He's a second degree black belt in Taekwondo, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt. We've seen a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt in the UFC make moves in a co-main event in 2022. Nick Maximo. Give him a round of applause. What an awful middleweight fight. It's the worst division in MMA right now. But when I look at this, I mean, Victor Altamirano, he's a guy over there. He's probably Yo-Yo Ma's favorite MMA fighter. Loves to play the cello. But if I can make one more musical reference about him, for Victor Altamirano, the takedown defense, very, very good when he strikes in volume, when he's at range, when it kind of closes into the mid-range, the fighting in a phone booth, he can struggle a little bit. It's he's like pitiful. If you're at the grocery store and you're listening and, you know, you might go, geez, what song is that? Well, it's Midnight City by M83. But, if you had that playing at a club, people be bumping. They'd be dancing. But if you play it at the grocery store and you turn the volume way down, you kind of get Victor Altamirano where it's like, I know that, but is it? What am I going to get here? And that's the big problem that I have when I look at Victor. I mean, this is a guy making his UFC debut in the flyweight division, a division that needs talent. Like when you go from 15 to 20... that's it. That really is it.
It's like the Mad Max world.
I look at Victor Altamirano. You got to start making moves and starting grooves before they knew we were gone. I expect a 31-year-old making a UFC debut to be able to go off to the races. And when I look at him, I don't see a guy that's going to make any moves in the top five. I think if you put him against Askar Askarov, you put him against Pantoja.
Yeah, a guy in his UFC debut can't beat Alejandro Pantoja.
You're 10-1 and 31 years old. You got to start going.
But still, we never talk about that with any other fighters making their UFC debut. So I don't really think you're giving him the credit he deserves. Like, we never say a guy in the middleweight division needs to beat Robert Whittaker after his debut, because that's insane. Like, Simon Oliveira, after he beat Trevin Giles, we were like, hey, you better be able to beat Paulo Costa next week. Like,
if a bantamweight ever beats a middleweight, Michael Morales at 22.
What I'm saying is, we never say that about a fighter. So I think you're extremely nitpicky about a guy like Altamirano. We really only have to worry about him fighting Carlos Hernandez this weekend. And in Hernandez, I also don't see a top five ceiling either. So I don't really think that pertains to this fight.
That's a big point that I have. And it relates to this fight, but it relates to a lot of the fighters that we're seeing coming into the UFC right now.
No, I hear you, but...
bridging around the age of 30, and we're in a division where there's only 20 to 25 fighters. Like, you really got to get moving. Now, good opportunity for both guys. So let's focus on Carlos Hernandez, former HFC flyweight champion. He's out of Chicago, trains out of VFS, and we know VFS Academy. We have another fighter on this card from that gym. It's Ignacio Bahamondes, but you've also seen Juliana Pena at that gym, bantamweight champion. You've got Bilal Muhammad, who's really had a bit of a run here of late. And when you look at it for Carlos Hernandez, does a lot of the similar things, but in different ways. I mean, for Hernandez, he can really strike in volume, but when you look at it for him, it's really putting the pressure on his opponent, really trying to back them up, and then once he is able to get them backed up, he does like to try and take the fight to the mat. The other thing that I like about Hernandez in this fight, because for Altamirano, all of the experience, from LFA 1 to LFA 100, the champion over there, you love to see it. For Hernandez, a little bit less in terms of pro experience, 2014 IMMAF champion over at the World Championships. Like, this guy has a ton of amateur experience. What was it? 13-2 as an amateur, and he is now 7-1 as a pro. He won his fight on Dana White's Contender Series by split decision. He had a hell of a fight over there. He definitely, it's the same thing as Altamirano. Lost the first round, and I thought that he won the second and the third against Daniel Baez coming over from Spain. And with Spanish prospects, to me in the UFC, it's kind of a mixed bag. You hope that they're Juan Espino. You hope that they're Joel Alvarez. But sometimes when you look at the level of competition, it's weird. Now, for Baez, he had a fight against Manel Kopp.
No disrespect to Juan Espino, but do you think anyone's like, I really hope I'm Juan Espino?
Just me. Just me. But when I do look at this, I love the level of experience out of that last fight. But other than that, it has been some weaker competition as a pro. But Hernandez is winning the ways that you want to see a guy win, too.
To me, this fight comes down to range management for both guys. Because if Carlos Hernandez can't get on the inside, he's going to get destroyed at kicking range. I truly do believe that. Because with Hernandez, you mentioned it, the Bilal Muhammad comp is a fair one. Again, Bilal Muhammad is like the best version of what Carlos Hernandez possibly could be. Because Hernandez does like to box himself into that wrestling range. And against a guy like Victor Altamirano, we know that he does struggle with his wrestling defense. And I do expect that to be a problem for him in this fight. But again, I do like Victor's cardio in this matchup. I do think that if he is able to at least keep it on the feet, and this is the weird thing, and I could be talked out of the point that I'm about to make, so please hear me out. I think the way that Altamirano defends takedowns is going to help him conserve energy because he doesn't fight for a lot of underhooks, because he isn't really going in there to wrestle out of a lot of those chain wrestling takedowns. He'll just sort of give up that top position, which again, I don't necessarily think is a good thing, but I do think for stamina management, it might actually help him because he has shown the ability to volume strike later on in his fights, and I'm not just going off his last performance either. If you go back and watch his fights, in the fourth and fifth round, he does look like a similar fighter to the guy who's in the first and second round, which does mean a lot about a fighter coming in, because how many prospects do we see where it's like, wow, their skills really jump off the page, and then the second they get tired, we're like, oh my goodness, that's a pretty big flaw. With Altamirano, I don't expect that to be a really big issue for him coming into the UFC, so for me, I do put a lot of stock into that, so I do see this as being very much a distance management fight for both guys. If Victor can keep his back off the fence, keep it in the middle of the cage, and really keep it where he can throw his kicks, I think he's going to have a ton of success. And on the flip side, if Hernandez can cut off the cage effectively, which is going to be difficult to do, again, that is one of those skills that it normally takes you to get into the top 15 before you really perfect it. Look at a guy like Sean Strickland. Kind of good when he would follow his opponent, but now that he cuts them off and gets them up against the cage, a much improved fighter. If Hernandez can cut off Victor and get him up against the cage, I do think he'll be able to have a lot of success with his takedowns and with his boxing. I just think on the feet, Altamirano is the much more dangerous fighter.
And that's the scary thing. You brought it up, and I brought it up earlier. You rolled your eyes. But the scariest part about this is we got to talk about guys being able to cut the cage at this stage in their career, 28 and 31 respectively, in their UFC debuts. It doesn't get any easier than this, and at flyweight, it is so easy to get a couple of wins together and make a move. I mean, think about it. Amir Albazi's unranked. Imagine if that guy was able to have a few more fights. I think he would blow a lot of these prospects out of the water. But here I am sitting here looking at this fight. When we look at the odds for this one, a little bit of a surprise because they've kind of switched poles. I mean, Victor Altamirano, open to minus 150 favorite. He's a plus 101 right now. For Hernandez, open to plus 130. He's a minus 123. If we look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us as they are to you. Matt, I'm going to say over under, going with the Mexican fighter, the former LFA champ. I'll give him benefit of the doubt. I'm going to say 65% for Altamirano.
I think they'll be under. I think they'll be closer to 50-50.
Oh boy. 578 total votes, 82% Altamirano, a 91% by decision for the 18% that have Hernandez, 70% by decision. And listen, we've really given both of these guys their flowers, or at least we've tried to. My negativity just extends overall to the prospects in this division because it really is a tough one. Unless you're like a world champion from another organization, you come in, you have a great opportunity. It's just, I'm down on the fact that lately the average age of a UFC prospect is between 29 and 31. But when it comes to this fight, I love Victor Altamirano. I love his southpaw stance. I like Carlos Hernandez based on the fact he's also a Pan-American kickboxing champion. Yes, HFC, LFA, totally different levels of competition. Out of Hernandez's wins, the combined opponent record is 8-5, which is not very good when you have, you know, six wins before Dana White's Contender Series. I love the stick-to-itiveness for both of these guys. We wouldn't have this as a well-matched fight, or we wouldn't view it as a well-matched fight if it weren't like that. But for me, I like Hernandez because the guy doesn't stop pressuring and working the takedowns. And that's why I think it's going to pay out. Again, for Altamirano, I love the striking. I think ultimately, yeah, you know, you look at the trajectory for both of these guys in terms of how they've been winning their fights, I could definitely see this one going the distance as well.
I just think Hernandez is going to be eating a lot of damage when he does try to get in range. And I do think that that's going to accumulate quite a bit over time. I'm not predicting a finish for either guy, but I do think Altamirano is at least the more dangerous guy on the feet. And even on the mat too, I will say, with Altamirano, I don't think he has high level submission ability. Like, this was always my point with Ciryl Gane, and why I would kind of roll my eyes when you talk about his submission ability, because he's good at submitting guys outside the rankings, but he's probably not going to use that to beat ranked fighters. With Altamirano, I don't expect him to be able to out-grapple ranked fighters in this division, but I do think that if he is able to fatigue guys, I think he will be at least tricky on the mat with some fighters, and he might be able to catch a neck here or there, but I think my overall prediction will be Altamirano, but I think this will be a great fight for both guys.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. We're split on the pick. Matt going with Team Mexico. I have Chicago's own Carlos Hernandez. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. You will not find a longer breakdown on unranked debuting UFC flyweights than you will here with Fight Night Picks. So let us know how you feel about that one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Papa, what are we doing here? We have a fight coming up this weekend at welterweight between Ramiz Brahimi coming out of Fortis MMA on the wrong side of a decision his last time out. That was back in January against Court McGee, where the crusher just continued to pressure and work the cardio of Ramiz Brahimi till I thought he was going to give up, but he didn't. And now we have Michael Gilmore coming in here. He's 6-4 as a pro, losing his last two bouts. One of them, it's on the Ultimate Fighter, so does it really count? But if you look at it in his last fight, he comes in on short notice. He takes on Andre Petroski. He had a good second round.
He did.
I can say that. But in the first round, in the third round, Gilmore was absolutely held down. And I mean, for Petroski, he comes in with a huge college wrestling background. And he either wins in the first round or gets beat in the second round due to exhaustion. And oddly enough, in his last two fights, the one against Gilmore, and then when he took on Hu Yao Zhang, UFC zone, he was 3-2 in that fight. He was able to get a nice win in the third round and a nice win in the third round against Gilmore. But again, the references don't really stop here, because I look at this one, I don't know what you're feeling about this one, B, but overall, it really is a buy low, sell low opportunity on both of these guys.
So this is what I guess I just get to poke fun at. You were a fan of Ramiz Brahimi at one point, but he has not been good in the UFC whatsoever.
Like, now let me defend the point. But back in 2018, Ramiz Brahimi at the time was undefeated. Every win was by submission. They were all very quick. And then since then, he's alternated wins and losses on a Charles Rosa or Randa Marcos-esque streak in his last eight fights. Now, he lost the last fight, so he's going to win this fight. If you want to play that game. But that game's stupid. But the craziest part is, Matt, cardio abandoned him. Now we're going to fight a month later? What?
If you lose to Court McGee, you just don't do it for me. That's just what I'm going to say from here on out. Because if you lose to... here's the thing about Court McGee. If you knock him out, you knock him out and you win the fight. We've seen that happen a few times now.
Twice,
exactly. He doesn't lose that often. But if you lose to him, he's probably going to eat your big shots, out-wrestle you, and it's going to be a really close fight in the decision. Ramiz Brahimi got dropped by Court McGee. That's a thing that happened in their fight. And that's a very concerning thing for me, because for Brahimi, I just don't think he's going to be able to strike very much with Gilmore whatsoever. And on the flip side, Gilmore can't grapple with Ramiz in this fight. So, again, this is why I sort of zag when you say this is a card you should give to your friends who haven't really watched MMA, because they can get it on the ground level, follow some of these prospects up. The worst version of this fight is Gilmore might have a little bit of success in the feet. Brahimi takes him down with like 3 minutes left in the first round, works for a submission that he never gets, and then you get two of the most tired fighters you've ever seen for another 10 minutes.
So this one's tricky, because again, it's hard to get excited for a guy that's 6-4. It's hard to get excited for a guy that's 9-4. And in the UFC, for Ramiz Brahimi, he got outstruck by Max Griffin. Max Griffin's a hell of a striker.
He's
and a good
boxer.
Hands. But, his ear gets flopped off, and then he goes out there and he submits Sasha Plotnikov very quickly. So it lends credence to, okay, Ramiz, I'm a first-round submission artist. And then...
Wait, to quote Smash Mouth, were you a believer after that fight?
I'd go with the monkeys version, but I was always a believer, so unfortunately I'm still here.
No doubt in your mind.
And then that loss to Court McGee. So I really had to go through and look at this fight this way. I had to break down the X's and O's for both guys, because for Ramiz... He was a big-time hitter over with LFA. And, I mean, that's the big thing. That's my first part of my notes. Chuck's leather. He throws tons of power on the feet. And it's worked for him in the past where I go just swinging in, drop the guy, take him down, submit him. And it goes out to, all the different highlight reels. But a consequence of that is... His cardio is not great, and it's been a kind of a constant throughout his career. It's not just the Max Griffin fight. It's not just the Court McGee fight. It's all the fights, because he finishes them quick if he wins. He has 9 wins. All of them are by submission. Again, he is a lights-out offensive grappler. But defensively, he has some holes. And then another one that I have in here, again, gas tank and in-fight adjustments. Those are the two big keys, because when it starts to go bad for Ramiz... Oh, we're down bad. And that really is the kicker. So this fight, it is a bit of a short notice. We were supposed to have the Mullet King, the man himself, Johnny Parsons, making his UFC debut. And Gilmore was supposed to get that fight. But Parsons out, Brahimi in. For Gilmore, they brought him in. He was an alternate on the Ultimate Fighter. So they bring him in and he fights Gilbert Urbina. And he gets knocked out. And then Andre Petrosky is looking for a dance partner in the UFC. He... Maybe he was going to fight Brian Battle on short notice, but no, Gilbert Urbina gets that fight. So Andre Petrosky gets Michael Gilmore. And here's my question to the UFC. That's a UFC fight. It's not an Ultimate Fighter fight. Why do they make them wear Ultimate Fighter trunks? Like, it just doesn't make any sense. It's so Mickey Mouse. Don't do that. But overall, for Michael Gilmore, 8-2 amateur record from 2015 back to 2012. A win by decision over Chaos Williams, his training partner now, Murciélago MMA. I mean, Joaquin Buckley's at that gym. Commander Dale Brown is adjacent. Hey, winning coach in the UFC.
You've never done that, Craig.
I have not. But really, when I do look at this, Michael Gilmore looked like his body type fit, 185 pounds. He's fought at 170 before. Don't get me wrong. I'm eager to see what he looks at 170 for this fight. And the other note that I have, I mean, he got taken down and controlled by Petrosky, but... As I said earlier, in the second round of his fight against Petrosky, he looked amazing. He was starting to throw at range, and he looked really, really good, backing Petrosky up. And Petrosky was eating shots.
And I think it's fair to say, though, Petrosky is a much better pure wrestler than Ramiz Brahimi. Now, once it gets to the grappling aspect, I would definitely favor Brahimi with his ability to finish the submissions on the mat. But that's my problem. Like, for where the odds are, and I don't normally say this, I think this is an awful fight to bet on. Because here's the thing. For Ramiz... His striking defense is an absolute zero. Like, blocking punches with your face doesn't count. That's not the objective of the sport. It's to move out of the way. But against a guy like Gilmore, it only takes one or two combinations to really hurt someone like Ramiz Brahimi. And I can easily see Gilmore landing something big early, hurting Ramiz. And Ramiz just never really being able to recover early on in the fight. And Gilmore ends up winning via TKO. But the flip side is, Brahimi could go out there looking like the second coming of Damian Maia. But the problem is, and I think you'd agree with this, I don't think the result of this fight really changes either guy's destiny. Like, if Ramiz Brahimi beats Michael Gilmore, if you're a fan of his or not coming into the UFC, I don't really think that's going to all of a sudden make you think, wow, he's destined for the top 15. And the same thing vice versa. Like, if Gilmore is able to knock out Ramiz in the first round, I just think it speaks more to the questions that we had around Ramiz Brahimi more than anything. So I still think this fight does very much for either guy in their careers.
Well, and the weirdest part about this one, Ramiz Brahimi on the limited sites that have odds on this one, open to minus 400. He's about a minus 300 for Gilmore. Open to plus 330. He's a plus 243. If we have a look at top Apology, surprise to us, it is to you.
Ooh.
409 total votes, 92% Brahimi, 70% by submission for the 8% that have Gilmore, 64% by decision, 24% by knockout. I do feel weird about this fight because, okay, I'll ask you this. Johnny Parsons, Gilmore, who would you favor to win that fight?
Gilmore definitely has a better chance in that fight, I'd say. But here's the thing. In this one... Probably Parsons, yeah.
Yeah, Johnny Parsons would have won that fight. So when I look at this one, I mean, Gilmore is going to go up against Parsons, who has friggin' bombs in his hands. Yes. He can take you down. Like, Johnny Parsons is is an interesting cat, I'll say that. For Ms. Brahimi, I hate to pick him. I'm picking him. I think he's going to be able to get the win because I don't like Michael Gilmore's takedown defense, and I don't like the fact that when he gets his back to the mat, it's a lot of time with his back to the mat. So for me, I'm going with Ramiz Brahimi in this one. But listen, if you were thinking of anchoring a parlay with Ramiz Brahimi, you're insane. You're insane.
I don't want to pick Ramiz, Craig, but I'm probably going to. I'll pick Brahimi, but this fight is so one way or the other. Either Gilmore wins because he looks like, I don't know, Jean-Claude Van Damme in the first round.
Go watch that second round of the Petrosky fight. I can't stress that enough.
Or Brahimi chokes him unconscious and he looks really, really good. I'll favor the grappler in this matchup. But again, I don't think it's going to change my opinion no matter what the result is of this fight.
Yeah, one last mark on Michael Gilmore. Coming into the UFC, he had an interesting record. And of his 6 wins, his combined opponent's record was 8-9. That's not very good. Both of us going with Texas' own Ramiz Brahimi in this fight. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have, because I know a lot of people, like I said earlier, it's buy low and sell low. And they're going to be very low on both of these fighters. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, we have Turbo versus Dragon in a battle of competitive dance teams or highly talented bantamweights. And listen, for Mexico's Alejandro Perez, this is a long time, where you at type of guy. Because it was just really, really weird. I mean, I was sitting doing my notes for this fight, and I was listening to the Hair Metal Essentials playlist that was on Apple Music. And the song that came on was I Remember You by Skid Row. And listen, I'm a Sebastian Bach guy. I mean, he was on Trailer Park Boys. They were trying to have the train convention in Maine. Dirty Old Skowhegan, and so on and so forth. But when it comes to that song, I would think that way about Alejandro Perez. This is a guy that won the Ultimate Fighter Season 1 of Latin America in 2014. The headliner of that card, UFC 180, his coach, Cain Velasquez, like, that was a big, big deal. And for Perez, after that fight, he would go on to go 7-1-1 and then have a 2-fight losing streak and just be gone forever, it seemed. And I mean, you look at the losses, Cody Stamann, where he's able to defend all of the takedowns, all 8 of them, and they strike. And then his next time out, he gets finished in the first round against Sung Yadong. And those fights were just months apart. That was kind of the crazy part about it. Like, Perez was really looking to just continue to ride the wave of momentum. And this is a guy, he had a performance of the night against Ian Entwistle. Huge win there. And then he just takes this a long time away. And I would have thought for a guy that's pretty well in his physical prime, hey, we're going to want to hit the ground running. But he took the time away. So he makes his second time out, and it's been so much time. I can't stress that enough. He takes on Johnny Eduardo. Brazil's David Ortiz, because who the hell knows how old Johnny Eduardo is? Different sites say he's 43, different sites say he's in his 30s. I don't know. I haven't seen the birth certificate, but what I can tell you is that in Alejandro Perez's walk out, it's mentioned that he's been at AKA. He's been at AKA since he met Cain Velasquez. He's been there forever. And Daniel Cormier pipes up and says, yeah, he's been at AKA, but for this camp, he's been away. And in this time away, he spent time away from his family, time away from his gym. He's worked on his wrestling with a wrestling coach. He's really gone soul searching. And you know what, Matt? It paid off in his last fight. Like, yeah, he did get caught a little bit on the feet, threw a nice right hook that kind of started to swell up Johnny Eduardo. And in the second round, how many submissions have we ever seen where you use your legs to submit a guy's arm? It's not often that you do see that. But for Perez, looked really good on the ground, but primarily known as a bang up type of striker. Like, a lot of fun.
I was going to say he fights like a better version of Enrique Barzola. Then I realized if you don't know who Alejandro Perez is, you definitely don't know who Enrique Barzola is.
But they train together.
They do. But you see what I mean. Good volume striking on the feet. Can use the wrestling offensively and defensively if things do go south on the feet. But my issue with Perez is when he throws punches, he is very susceptible to the counter strike. Like, we even saw that against Johnny Eduardo. And that's why I disagree with you a little bit about him looking better in the Eduardo fight, because it's something we bring up a lot, how sometimes you can look better in a loss, and sometimes you can look worse in a win. I thought Alejandro Perez didn't look all that great in that win against Johnny Eduardo, because let's be honest, Johnny Eduardo, even in his prime, was barely a top 15 fighter, and he is nowhere near his prime anymore. So to me, for Perez to look good against Eduardo, but still get pieced up on the feet a little bit, it does give me cause for concern, especially when you're going in there against a guy like Jonathan Martinez, who Yes, we understand what the faults are of Dragon, of Jonathan Martinez. But Martinez in his best version has phenomenal volume striking, a really good kicking repertoire. He has very diverse kicks. He has good front kicks, good roundhouse kicks too from both sides. And that's the thing about Jonathan Martinez. Offensively, I would say that there are a few fighters who can match him on the feet with their volume striking. I know that's a bit of a hot take, but he really does have great offensive striking on the feet. The problem is, himself, just like Alejandro Perez, is susceptible to getting hit by the counter shot. So to me, I look at this fight and think, okay, who's more likely to land the one big shot on the feet? Perez has okay power, but as we saw against Johnny Eduardo, he doesn't really have that one-punch knockout power with his hands or his feet. With Jonathan Martinez, listen, I'm not going to try to sell you a picture saying he hits like Chaos Williams, but he does have good finishing ability on the feet and on the mat, and that's why I do find myself siding with Martinez. But this is what I think is so important about this fight. It's make or break for both guys. I mentioned this earlier on, we had this in the fight of the night screen. For Perez, was in the top 15, was a hyped up prospect at one point, but like you said, he's been cursed by inactivity, he did have a few bad losses, the Song Yadong one being really, really bad, like that's a tough knockout to suffer, but he didn't do himself any favors. Like Ben Simmons, he had that really bad series against Atlanta. It just went into hiding. Like, if he came back, had a good preseason, maybe had a good start to the season, people would kind of forget what happened in the playoffs. If Perez came back after that Song Yadong loss, fought another guy sort of around his ranking, then maybe we would look at him in a different light, and maybe we would have a different second half to his career. I just don't put a lot of stock into his win over Johnny Eduardo, and I do think he's going to struggle a lot at range in this matchup with Jonathan Martinez.
Alejandro Perez took almost 2.5 years off between the Song Yadong loss and the win over Johnny Eduardo, and this is a guy that walks out to Believer by Imagine Dragons. Now, Road FC's Jay Hukyo absolutely owns that song. Unless you sing it on the way into the cage, I don't trust you. For Perez, I go through and I watch the tape. These are some of the things that you need to look out for, because it really is weird. I mean, he holds his hands up really high like a tie stance, leaves his body completely open. Jonathan Martinez from Southpaw rips kicks to the body. Like, I think of Martinez in a similar light to a guy like a Jourdain, who he's going to rip those kicks. They're going to go to the legs. They're going to go to the body. He can whip them up to the head. I love that out of that Southpaw look that I have from Martinez. But another one of those things, again, really good takedown defense for Perez. I don't think we're going to see that out of Martinez. If anybody's going to wrestle, I would see it as Perez. Jonathan Martinez, not a bad defensive wrestler, but when you're going to Factory X Muay Thai, you're not necessarily going to try and accentuate your wrestling game. Obviously, you're going to have some looks from Alexander Hernandez, kind of in the similar weight class, so to speak. Yikes. But when it does come down to this fight, I mean, I do look at it. For Martinez, it's been a mixed bag, right? Because you look at the losses, loses to Andre Sukumtoth coming in on relatively short notice, very, very unknown commodity at that point. He has that fight against Andre Yule where the judges scored it 30-27 and 29-28 for Andre Yule on MMA decisions. 12 scored at 29-28 Martinez, 1 scored at 30-27 Martinez. That was that crazy Joe Solis in Houston. Probably shouldn't be a judge, but that one happened. But then Martinez's awful critical flaw of a loss was against Davey Garcia, who went right hook to the body. And as Martinez brings his hands down, it's left hook to the head and drops him. So again, Perez is one of those guys. He loves to throw the hooks to the body. And it's a part of his game that I really do like. Perez is also a guy that from range, he will throw just a straight shot to the body to try and give a different look. I think in this fight, he can get caught because Martinez is such a speedy striker. So I look at the odds for this fight. Perez open a plus 180, roughly still there. Martinez open a minus 220, roughly still there. We're going to look at the Tapology votes, Matt. I'm going to say over under 75% Martinez. What would you say?
I'll say over.
You're going to say over. Look at that. 581 total votes, 80% Martinez, 74% by decision for the 20% that have Perez, 70% by decision. I think this is going to be a great fight on the feet. I just like the speed and the volume out of Martinez in this one. But listen, I never miss an Alejandro Perez fight. What about his walkouts and his weigh-ins? Are they fun too?
He's just like, listen, I can be awkward in social settings too. Don't get me wrong. But like Alejandro Perez is out here like flexing at the camera, just like wearing sunglasses, taking them off, putting them on 19 times. It's just a little weird. And it's one of those things like on question mark kicks is like, hey, how much did the weigh-in affect them? I have no idea if Alejandro Perez is the most drawn-out man in the world, or if he's just, like, strange in front of the camera. So, it always leaves me with a lot more questions than answers during his weigh-ins. Hopefully there's no confusion. My final pick is Jonathan Martinez, though. I think knees to the body and just his overall reactionary knees, because like you said, Perez does like going to the body, and that does leave his head open for Martinez to throw those knees up the middle. I think those are going to be a really big attack in this fight, so I'll pick Jonathan Martinez.
Big time opportunity. Will it be the career resurgence of a guy who does weigh-in day like Diego Sanchez, or will it be Jonathan Martinez who will not say a word at weigh-in day, let alone the entire week? So, an interesting fight coming up this weekend nonetheless in the best division in MMA. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have, and keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Former Atomweight star Jinyu Fry coming in here this weekend, taking on current Instagram star, we have 24K, Hannah Goldie, in a battle of fighters who are at strawweight, but both taller than tonight's featherweight, Josianne Nunes. How crazy is that? It doesn't make any sense to me, nor to you, probably nobody else. But the fight that we have in front of us here, it's a very important one in this division because while it might not implicate the rankings just yet, these fighters are definitely rankings adjacent. For Hannah Goldie, an interesting fight her last time out. She was able to get her first UFC win over 4-4 Emily Whitmire, the old Spitfire, that didn't know at the World MMA Awards who Brian Campbell or Luke Thomas were when she presented them with their award. I thought that was funny. They thought it was funny. She thought it was funny. Everybody had a laugh. Maybe we'll be up for that this year, but probably not. However, what I will say was, for Hannah Goldie, we got to see a different dimension out of her game. Something that we weren't used to. Something that deviated from the norm. Because what I thought I knew of Hannah Goldie was extreme strength and volume striking. And it's been a ton of volume striking. That was her first submission win in many, many moons. And opposite her in this fight, we have Jinyu Fry, you know, former Invicta champ. She's fought the best atomweight fighters of all time. And we can go through and do a deep dive on her record. But all of this to say that in Jinyu Fry's four UFC fights against Kay Hansen, Loma Lookbanmi, Gloria DePaula, and Ashley Yoder, this is the disclaimer, we have picked against Jinyu Fry, both of us, in all four of those fights. And that was the deep dive that I wanted to do on this fight because I thought Gloria DePaula was going to have the advantage in the striking. I thought Ashley Yoder, with her length, with her grappling and her size, she was going to be able to win out in that fight. But no, those things did not happen. So we're 2-2 in those fights. Jinyu Fry is also 2-2 in those fights. So Matt, again, with that disclaimer out there that we haven't picked Jinyu Fry in a single UFC fight, what do you have to say in this fight? Because again, for Fry, she's normally undersized against most fighters, but she actually has a reach advantage in this fight. And she has sort of later on in her career, I'm not saying she's a strawweight, but she fills out well enough at strawweight.
And I'm glad you said that because I do think that is a really important point. I know people are sick and tired of me feeding this dead horse, but Jinyu Fry is not a strawweight.
We're trying not to say beating a dead horse. So we say feeding a fed horse, but you're just trying to feed a dead horse. And that's the weirdest thing anybody's ever said.
That's why I combined the two. Come on, Craig. Don't dissect everything. The problem with Jinyu Fry is that she really doesn't belong to this division, but I do think that if you look at her record and her first two performances compared to her last two performances, it's kind of like when Max Holloway fought Dustin Poirier at lightweight the second time around. I know that's a weird fight to go to, but I do think that's a good fight to bring up because if you look, both guys were at featherweight fighting at lightweight, but Poirier had years to really fill into that division and become an actual UFC lightweight, whereas for Holloway, it was just sort of a quick pit stop. He just wasn't cutting the extra weight. With Jinyu Fry, I feel like her first two fights in this division, she was just not cutting the weight. She hadn't really filled into the strawweight division. Whereas now, she does look a little bit bigger. But this is my issue. If only now you're starting to come into your own physically, especially in this division, at the age of 36, I just wonder about what your overall ceiling can be. We know how good she was in her prime and in her own weight class, but it's one of those things, and again, people are probably sick and tired of me talking about basketball, but it's like how some star players, they're really good on a team that's sort of built around that player. Like James Harden in Houston. You can shoot the ball every time you touch it. Everything's going to be built around you. That's kind of like Jinyu Fry at atomweight. You're the physical fighter. Like, everything's sort of built to your specifications. Whereas at strawweight, you're not always the strongest fighter. You're not always going to have the wrestling advantage. Sometimes you might have the wrestling advantage, but since you lack the physicality, your opponent can just kind of make up for their lack in technique. I just think with Frey at this division, she's always going to run into a weird roadblock with her physicality, especially with someone like Goldie, who might not be the most technical fighter, might not be the most heavy-handed fighter, but she is so damn strong physically that you know somebody who doesn't really fit into this weight class is going to be at a huge detriment, especially when it comes to the clinch.
Hannah Goldie Goldie looks strong. She probably is strong. She has 50% takedown defense against a poor level of UFC sure. competition so far. I mean, Miranda Granger, the first loss, that was at 125. Diana Balbizia, where she almost gets finished in the first round on the feet. Like, it was not a good performance. And then she beats 4-4 Whitmire. So it's been a mixed bag out of these two. I mean, I go down, I look at my notes. Negative 1.2 strike differential for Jinyu Frey in the UFC. Positive 1.2 for Goldie, even though she's 1-2. Like, it really is kind of splitting hairs. So when I do look at the way that both of these women fight, this is my major takeaway. For Jinyu Frey, she has the length in this fight in terms of the striking or the reach advantage that she has. But for her to win, she has to crash distance against a lot of fighters. Like, you see it in the Ashley Yoder fighter, a much bigger fighter. When Jin fights behind the jab and then she paws the overhand left and throws it out there, she's able to crash in and back up. Until in the second round, Ashley Yoder, at minute three, go back and watch that fight. At minute three, Ashley Yoder has her hands to her side and her head, like, not even looking at the clock, just looking up. She looks completely dejected. And then about 40 seconds later, she goes, jab, right hand, jab, right hand. She throws it five times, back to back to back, and Jinyu Frey's hands are here, and she just continues to eat the combination. So, did not like that when I went back to see it. Really good takedown defense out of Jinyu Frey, but again, when she takes on different fighters, like Loma Lookbanmi is not a big fighter, but some Thai fighters have really good takedown defense just off of the defensive hips, and for Loma, she was able to defend all the takedowns off of that. When I look at Hannah Goldie, I mean, volume striking, you submitted Emily Whitmire, but that doesn't add to the mystique of Hannah Goldie, if you know where I'm going with this.
But on the flip side, though, beating someone like Ashley Yoder doesn't really add to the mystique of Jinyu Frey, and I just really think that speaks to how hard this fight is to predict. That's true.
So we look at the odds for this. Jinyu Frey, open to minus 125. She's minus 185. For Hannah Goldie, open to plus 105. She's plus 142. If we have a look at the topology votes, Matt, surprise to us there to you. Frey almost a 2-1 favorite at this point. So I'm going to set the over-under at 67.5%. What do you say?
I think it'll be over.
I think it's going to be over. And it is. What is that? 617 total votes. 76% for the former atomweight champ with Invicta. 93% of the fans have her to win by decision. For the 22% that have Goldie, 78% by decision. And Matt, for both of these women, not really known for winning necessarily by finish. So how do you see this one playing out?
I think Frey's the more technical fighter, and for that reason, I do have to pick her. Again, could I be wrong because Hannah Goldie can outmuscle some positions? Could she outstrike Frey in the feet? Yes, of course she could. But I do think when I have to break this fight down, I do think Frey's the more technical one. So if it does go to the mat, I think she should be able to out-grapple Hannah Goldie, especially if you have prolonged grappling sequences. If it's just a flash here or there, Goldie will be able to use her physicality to buck out of some of those positions. But if Frey can actually get her on the ground, get her flat on her back, and really start to expose some of the holes in her grappling, I do think Jinyu Frey can have a lot of success.
Yeah, the weirdest part about it is for Goldie, she has a great opportunity on Dana White's Contender Series, gets the win over Kaylee Robbins, then loses to Granger, loses to Diana Balbizia, gets outstruck, gets knocked down, but she takes Balbizia down. That's not going to work in this fight. And she gets taken down a couple times by Whitmire and ends up getting the submission her last time out there. So for me, I do like Jinyu Frey in this fight. So this is a first for Fight Night Picks in 5 Jinyu Frey fights. This is the first time we picked her to get the win. So a big red flag out there on this one. But both of us going with the fighter out of Genesis BJJ, Jinyu Frey, to get the win coming up this weekend. And you're not going to want to miss the main event of this card. Bobby Green saving it on short notice, taking on, is he a future champ, Islam Makhachev? You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend in the lightweight division. We have T-Rex Terrence McKinney taking on the smile killer Farah Ziem out of France. Can't wait for France, or at least somewhere close to France. I mean, hey, London's got a card coming up. You love to see it. But UFC over in Europe definitely needs a big time boost, and it's with fighters like the K1 kickboxer that is Farah Ziem. What a fun guy to watch. And for Terrence McKinney, probably the best UFC debut ever. I mean, really, his win over Matt Frivola, kind of aging like a fine wine, but it has been a while since we've seen McKinney in the cage. And this fight right here was booked not that long ago, but the fight falls out. It's rebooked. We have an entire video about it. So we'll throw it on over to the original prediction video. We'll offer up the new odds and a final pick and prediction on this one. We had T-Rex Terrence McKinney looking to make his Cam Newton return. I'm back, and he's coming back off of that crazy win in his debut. It was over in 7 seconds when he knocked out Matt Frivola. Then he got crazy with the end, and he T-wrecked his knee, so he's been off for a while. He's going to be taking on Francis Farazim, a guy that personally I've been negative about in the past, but I think he's got some big X factors coming up, especially in a meeting with McKinney this weekend. This is a guy, he's coming from K1 kickboxing lineage, and if you look at it for Ziem, since he joined the UFC, yeah, you're going to lose to Don Madge, a PFL fame, but his last two fights against Jamie Mullerkey and Luigi Vendramini, both wins on paper. They were very close fights, and I can really give a conversation either way. However, when the fight is standing, Farazim can beat a lot of lightweights in this world, and he has a great opportunity coming up this weekend against Terrence McKinney. Both of these guys, I think, have very interesting ceilings in this division, too.
I couldn't agree more, and the great thing about Ziem is that, yes, those two past fights were really close, but the level of competition's pretty good. Like, Luigi Vendramini, okay, maybe public perception's not great of him, but still, if you know, you know. And if you know, he's a pretty talented fighter and a very well-rounded one at that. And we all know how good Jamie Mullerkey is. Like, he's extremely well-rounded, he's got great power. So, I do agree with you. Very close fights, but still, it's not like he's having close fights with guys who are fresh off Contender Series. Now, on the flip side, Terrence McKinney's one of the more interesting prospects in this division right now, because a lot of people will remember. Paddy Pimblett gets his great UFC debut, looks great against Vendramini, gets rocked, knocks him out. And then people are saying, hey, does he have the best UFC debut of the year? Is he kind of the rookie of the year? And there was another UFC lightweight who was very open to disagreeing with that, and it was Terrence McKinney. He was like, hey, I knocked out Matt Frivola in 7 seconds. Why is nobody talking about my shine? And I think it is time to give Terrence McKinney his flowers, because he's shown an evolution in his game as of late, which has been really, really impressive.
Let's talk about it, because for McKinney,
that's what he was gonna do.
Everybody just assumes that he's a guy that gets it done with his hands, right? Like, you look at those last four fights, done in 16 seconds, 17 seconds, a minute 12, and then 7 seconds. Knocking guys out cold. Matt, what's his primary skill?
If you've been paying attention to the countdown this week, you'll know that his high school wrestling coach is on this card. He's been wrestling with guys like Michael Chiesa since he was in high school, and that really is the Terrence McKinney sort of back pocket trick, if you will. He can always go to his wrestling base. Now, is he one of these like JUCO national champion wrestlers? No. Is he a Curtis Blades type of wrestler? No. But is he someone who has really good MMA wrestling? Yes. And I really do think that's the key to this. You can't always look at a guy's accolades and all of a sudden think that that's going to translate to MMA. Like, Yoel Romero is probably a good example of that. Is he a good wrestler in MMA? Yeah. Is he the best MMA wrestler ever? Probably not, if we're being honest. Like, there's other guys out there who are better, even though he's the one with an Olympic gold medal. Terrence McKinney's another guy who sort of proves that, that even though he doesn't have the collegiate background or the wrestling, or the Olympic background, sorry, he's got really good MMA wrestling, and it's going to be a big factor in this fight, because at range, Farazim's a guy who not only can put a lot of volume together, he's somebody who can start mixing in combinations early on in the fight, and if you're caught 6 feet away from him because it seems like he can hit you from across the cage, it's going to be a really, really long night in the office for you, because you're so far away from him that it's really hard to get your entries on any of your strikes or your takedown attempts.
Craziest part about this, people will disagree. If this is the thing that's clipped out there, if this becomes a YouTube short, I might look stupid, but here's the deal. Farazim is a better striker than Terrence McKinney. Terrence McKinney's great at blitzing forward and knocking guys out. You saw that in his last four fights. Terrence McKinney is a better MMA fighter because he can mix in his wrestling, and when he does, and he's on, and he doesn't make any mistakes with his grappling, he's a great fighter. I mean, look at it. When he's fighting Sean Woodson on Contender Series, he's beating Sean Woodson until he goes in, makes a dumb mistake, and then leaves himself totally exposed to a flying knee knockout for Woodson. Now, how good Sean Woodson, you might say? Well, he looked pretty good last weekend, I thought.
Tanks.
Just throwing to the body all day. So when I look at it for McKinney, you take that fight into account. Okay, he loses that fight. Then he goes out on a regional show. It's Contender Series against Contender Series. Derek Minner, Terrence McKinney. What does McKinney do? I'm going to wrestle. What does Derek Minner do? I'm going to submit him. And that's exactly what happened. So for McKinney, against very, very good primary grapplers, he might struggle with some of that jiu-jitsu, some of those in-betweens. Minner's a great guy in that respect. But when it comes to stringing everything together, that's what Terrence McKinney's great at. The trouble is, if you try and strike against a long-rangey guy and blitz in, we've seen what happened to him against a guy like Woodson. Farah Siam has a great opportunity to do something just like that. So in a fight like this, I have a lot of hesitations about going McKinney hard or going with Ziam quite hard as well. Because for Ziam, what's he struggled with? Third rounds against Luigi Vendramini? Takedown defense? Well, everybody knows that he's pretty well a pure kickboxer, so they just hammer away at the takedowns. Sometimes Ziam can grab one underhook and at least keep it up against the cage, but when he's stationary and he's striking from the clinch, he's at a giant disadvantage in his fights.
He really is. And the frustrating thing about Ziam is that his technique's good, his hand speed's good, his combinations are good. He doesn't really have great power on the end of his shots. I know he's got great striking acumen and a great striking background, but he's just not somebody who can go out there and really get one of those one-hit quitter knockouts. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens in this fight if McKinney has success early, especially with his strikes. This could be one of those weird bizarro worlds where maybe McKinney gets a knockdown early and it's the worst thing that ever happens to him, because then he gets confident with his power and he is sort of just getting picked apart on the outside trying to set up another one of those big overhands. The flip side is if McKinney can, and I think you set it up perfectly, just be that smart MMA fighter that we know he can be, then I think there's more than a big opportunity for McKinney to win. This is the thing that people got to remind themselves. The knockouts are recent. Like, they're a recent phenomenon. Now, that can be taken two different ways. Carlos Condit, before he went to the WEC, had a lot of submission wins against lower levels of competition. And for McKinney, some of that is true, to be completely honest. But McKinney is far more likely to take this to the mat out of these two guys. And I don't think Ziam can create separation. I guess that's the last thing I want to say. Ziam, like you said, is good at digging the underhook, but it'll just kind of sit there afterwards. You can hold him up against the cage with the underhook. And I do think that if McKinney doesn't just get discouraged after that initial takedown attempt, and if he does stay glued to Ziam, I think he's got a pretty good path to victory.
So the odds on this fight in the rebooking, the reshuffling, the rescheduling, they opened at par. Farah Ziam, the slight favorite in this one right now, somewhere in the range of a minus 125. The comeback on Terrence McKinney, anywhere between a plus 110 and a plus 115. So you heard what we had to say about this one. Obviously, with Terrence McKinney, he wrestles with reckless abandon. He also strikes that way too. And for Farah Ziam, a much more polished striker. Obviously, we saw that in the fight against Luigi Vendramini. But the kind of con to that one is he got taken down a fair amount in that fight against Luigi Vendramini. And he does tend to struggle with some of that takedown defense. But when it's on the feet, this guy is one of the most fun fighters to watch in this lightweight division. So overall, the takeaway, Matt, Ziam, slight favorite, McKinney, slight underdog. If we look at the votes on Topology, 628 total votes. They're going with the viral star. 76% of the McKinney, 75% by knockout. For the 24% that have Ziam, 72% by decision. So, Matt, you know, the final look on this fight, what are you thinking here?
This fight should be called, like, the Goldilocks fight. Because for Terrence McKinney, range is really going to matter. If he's all the way out, Farah Ziam is going to destroy him with his kicks. Going to go to the legs, going to go to the body, and really tire McKinney out. But if Terrence McKinney can box his way into the range, use his combinations, and land power shots up top, I think he's probably going to win by knockout. Like, Terrence McKinney has undeniable knockout power. He really does. A lot of people just look at his win at Matt Frivola, and they're like, okay, you knocked out Matt Frivola, who cares? He has multiple wins in under 10 seconds. Like, no, that's not a fluke. That is real legitimate knockout power. And I do think that if he lands on Ziam, he's going to put him away. So I will stick with the pick of Terrence McKinney.
And when I look through McKinney's record, again, he's got that loss to Sean Woodson. He was having success until he wasn't.
Yeah.
The fight against Derek Minner over with MFC. I had a great conversation with MFC's, you know, the guy that's in charge of Midwest fighting. And after that, I was really impressed. You know, if there's a chance that we can make it down there, I would definitely love to go to a card. Having said that, McKinney wrestles himself into a submission, so it was unfortunate to see it that way. But in a fight like this, I will take McKinney, but I have to say, I mean, Farah Ziam, again, when it comes to once he finds his range, it really can be over. It's just with McKinney, he has the X factor of the wrestling, and I really do like that in this fight.
And the thing about Ziam, he's a very skilled striker, but he's not a knockout striker by any means. I sort of lump him in with, I don't want to say Christophe Jocko, because Jocko is, like, he's not a knockout artist by any means, but with Ziam, it is a lot of volume. It is a lot of 1-2 leg kick. It's a lot of stuff that builds up over time. So if it ends early, it probably will be McKinney, but if it goes to decision, and if McKinney isn't able to get a lot of takedowns, I could see Ziam using a lot of volume, striking, and winning this by decision. So I think this will be a really closely contested matchup.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. Do you have Francis Farah Ziam, the smile killer, to get the win? Both of us going with T-Rex in this one. Terrence McKinney should be a great card. Tons of prospects on this one that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And a welcome to the UFC to Hong Kong's Ramona Pascual, making her short notice UFC debut at featherweight this weekend. Yes, I said featherweight, taking on Josiane Nunes. Her nickname's Josie, and she knocks fools dead. She has foolish power, and you absolutely love to see it in her fights. I mean, you don't often see women at 5'2" having success at 135, taking on taller fighters, putting them in plum clinches, throwing knees up the middle, and then finishing them. That doesn't happen, but it does in Josiane Nunes fights. And in her last time out, making her UFC debut as a slight underdog against Bia Malecki. I mean, Bia Malecki, Swedish national Muay Thai champion, and in that fight did not look like it, because for Nunes, she was able to just close the range and throw power shots up against the cage and finish that fight in Nunes fashion.
Now, this is why I have completely changed my opinion on Josiane Nunes, and I think it's very important to say. I thought she was going to get destroyed by Bia Malecki. I really did. Because to me, size at a certain point matters. And not just to me, like, it does in MMA. Rory McDonald, Gegard Mousasi is one of the best examples of this. Two guys who match up very closely on the feet, in grappling, and in wrestling, but one guy is much larger than the other guy. That fight wasn't even close. Gegard Mousasi destroyed him. In my mind, I thought, okay, I know you have to make weight classes, but Bia Malecki was quite obviously a much bigger fighter than Josiane Nunes. I think that's something we can all agree on. Nunes knocked her out like she was John Lineker fighting Michael McDonald. That's a deep cut right there. But Nunes really does have that fight-ending power. And it's weird because she's not overly technical for someone with her background. She's the type of fighter who goes in there looking for the knockout. I sort of match up with like a Vanderlei Silva in that respect.
Joe Anderson Brito.
Joe Anderson Brito, another good example where it's like, hey, I get knockouts because I show up to get knockouts. And the problem with that is when you show up to win by knockout, you quite often leave losing by decision. Because if you don't land those big power shots, you're going to get tired. It's like Gavin Tucker against Rick Glenn compared to Gavin Tucker against Sam Cecilia. The only difference in that fight was he didn't throw power punches against Sam Cecilia. He just let the volume speak for itself. Whereas against Rick Glenn, he threw every shot trying to knock him out and got exhausted early on. With Nunes, that's something you're always going to have to worry about because she does throw those fight-ending type of shots. But in these weight divisions and against unranked fighters in these weight divisions, head movement isn't all that prevalent. I think that's something we can all agree on. So Nunes, if she is matched up strategically on her way to the top, it'll be interesting to see if she does fight at featherweight or bantamweight. I expect her to be at bantamweight, but again, fighting someone like Malecki, who is very big, and having this fight at featherweight, be interesting to see if they do decide to keep the division open. Maybe she could fit in, but she's a tough night in the office for anybody.
Well, this is the craziest part about this fight, because originally Josiane Nunes was supposed to take on Wu Yanan, who had a knee injury. They replaced her with one of the craziest stories I've ever seen. Now, listen, reports differ, secondhand stories, Instagram posts, whatever you may have seen, but she was supposed to take on Jennifer Gonzalez Arenada, and I looked and went, oh, a debuting fighter at 35 at women's bantamweight? That's tough. And then USADA showed up to her gym in Chile, and things went off the rails. So please do read about that, because it was insane. That was news over the past weekend. So, in steps Hong Kong's Ramona Pascual, who, listen, if you look at her last two fights, those were her first two fights ever in North America. One with Icon, one over with Invicta. She was originally supposed to, in her last fight with Invicta, take on Courtney King. She fell out of that fight. King did. So, listen, Shamir Peshewa ends up in that fight. And I went, Shamir Peshewa? Doesn't she follow me on Twitter? I've seen her out there before. Yeah, that's her. So I tuned in for the fight. I tweeted. It was on the screen with Invicta. I was sitting here full of glee. And I enjoyed that card. It was a lot of fun. There was a headlining title fight. And nonetheless, Ramona Pascual goes into that fight and looks amazing. She made light work out of Peshewa. She's able to just whip different things to the body, throw her knees in there. And ultimately, it was a couple knees and a couple of punches to follow it up that ended up getting her a big first-round finish. She did some more interviews after the fact. So China Morning Post with friends of the show, Nico Atkin. And when I did look at that, it was like, okay, she wants to fight Courtney King again, probably wants to get herself into a title shot with Invicta. And keep in mind, we have it on the screen, her last fight was 150 pounds. That was a catchweight because it was on short notice, but she's talked about it in different interviews about the move that she's made from Hong Kong to the States. She trains at Syndicate. She's had a couple of camps at Syndicate now, her last two fights, and that was a big move to try and really start knocking down the door of the UFC. And the craziest thing for Ramona Pasquale, she was a national team member of the Hong Kong rugby squad. Like, you absolutely love to see that. She's the second fighter that I've really seen of late representing Hong Kong. Obviously, Sasha Platnikov did when he was around. But Ramona Pasquale, born and bred Hong Kong. You love to see it. Different representation from all over the world. But the craziest part about her is she spent a lot of time at the UFC Shanghai PI, really honing her craft over multiple years. She was a part of that academy, and you even saw it last year when corners were falling out and some of the people from Shanghai weren't able to represent, like Dean Amazinger, where we had Ramona Pasquale cornering Na Liang when she made her UFC debut in a crazy fight against Ariane Carnelosi. But Matt, when I go through this, Ramona Pasquale right now making her UFC debut at 33, but she just started MMA at 27. And when you look at the way that she fights, I think she's continued to get better. She obviously had a big layoff between 2017 and 2019, major knee surgery there, then a bit of a layoff from 2019 to 2021. But I do like what I've seen out of her in her last two fights. She loves to throw knees to the body, and it's not just one fight or two fights. That's her best move, a nice 1-2 to try and break things up. She's a tricky southpaw too. I just wonder if she kind of gets caught looking in the mirror, and that's an opportunity for Josiane Nunes, who just, I'm not joking, just runs across and blitzes people.
Do you know how scary it would be to be looking across the cage and just seeing Josiane Nunes sprinting across? Because here's the thing. She's legitimately a foot shorter than me, but she'd be throwing windmills like Deontay Wilder. I'd be terrified. I don't know about you, but that'd be a scary sight to see. This is my issue with Pasquale in this fight. She has to play Nunes's game to win. And I think that's a really tough ask for really anybody, because if she is going to be on the feet, content to throw 1-2 shots, trying to use her knee as her power strike up the middle, I really do think she's going to be on the receiving end of a lot of overhand and looping shots from Nunes, because it's very similar to kind of how Derek Lewis has a lot of his success. When people throw lazy kicks when they're on one leg, that's when he can capitalize by rushing forward. Nunes is very similar with how she times her own attacks. I do think that if Pasquale doesn't set up her kicks perfectly, if she does find herself being lazy, throwing out a naked leg kick here or there, throwing a naked knee to the body, that's when Nunes can really rush her and land those big combinations. I do expect her to do that in this fight.
And for Pasquale, if you look at it again, I mentioned the fact that her last fight was at 150 on short notice. She's fought at 145, she's fought at 135. When she had her consultations, and I want to give credit where it's due, I listened to an interview from last year with Asian MMA, Andrew Whitelaw, the interviewer. You might know him from doing different spots with Fight Circus, and I love watching Fight Circus. And ultimately, 135 will be her natural weight class. We'll see her there, but kind of the move for her, there weren't many opponents that you could find in China due to the restrictions, so that's why she ended up at Syndicate MMA. But you look at the level of training partner for somebody like Pasquale, I mean, not just Joanne Wood, John Wood in the corner, so on and so forth, but that's, we've seen so many fighters at Syndicate. I know we already mentioned Emily Whitmire this week or in this week's videos, but she's there featured prominently. But yeah, when it comes to this fight, I look at the odds. I don't honestly know where they're at. Tapology, for some reason, has Josiane Nunes as a minus 325 favorite, plus 250 on the comeback for Pasquale. I went on Best Fight Odds. There was only one site that had odds. The average Nunes right now, minus 175, Pasquale at a plus 150. So let's bring up the Tapology votes, see what the fans are thinking on this one.
Ooh.
And 393 total votes, 87% Nunes, 76% by
Did
knockout.
Did they think it was Amanda?
For the 13% that have Pasquale, 56% by submission, or sorry, by decision, and so on and so forth. But Matt, when I do look at this fight, Pasquale, I like her overall game. I don't necessarily love the volume. I think if you can weather the storm of the first round, you beat Josiane Nunes, because she fights herself into exhaustion. It's not just the one fight in the UFC. Go back and watch the fight tape. I want to give you an example. There's one fight where she takes on Juliana Araújo. That was back 2 years and 4 months
ago. No disrespect, but she's just some lady.
Araújo goes at her. Josiane Nunes, to defend, kind of puts her in a guillotine. They stay there for 4.5 minutes of the first round. It's awful. It's the worst. And her only loss on her pro record is to Tyler Santos by decision, who she now trains with when she goes to Astra Fight Team, which is a part of her regiment. So again, I look at this fight, I have Josiane Nunes, but if Ramona Pasquale ended up winning in the second round, third round decision, I could see it happen. The trouble for me, though, is Pascual tends to hold her hands a little low, and she's not the most volume-heavy fighter. Great top pressure when she does get there. I mean, you go back to her second-to-last win that she had over Guadalupe Guzman, who was making her pro debut over with Icon at Icon 7. She gets her into a mounted crucifix and absolutely goes bonkers. Cuts her to the forehead. It's great. But again, overall, I do have Nunes. I think those bursts, normally I don't think they work against many people. I think this is a fight that they will.
That's why I don't think Pascual has the highest ceiling, to be honest. Like, I think her striking's okay, but I do think she lacks the power to really get a lot of people's respect on the feet at the UFC level. They'll be interesting to see, because let's say she goes out there, weatherstorm against Nunes. You could be right. She could look really good later on in the fight. I just think Nunes, you kind of know what you're going to get with her. If it goes bad, it's going to go horrible. It's going to be like a Rodolfo Vieira loss, where you're like, wow, really? Like, this is how we're going to lose? But with Nunes, the peaks are very high, but so are the valleys, let's just say that. And I do think she'll be able to get another knockout win if she is able to get Pascual up against the cage. There's few women's fighters who have the devastating punches at this weight class that Nunes does. I really do think she is at like a tier of her own when it comes to power punching. I do think we'll see that this weekend.
Both of us going with Brazil's Josiane Nunes to get the win. Let us know down below if you have Hong Kong represent Ramona Pascual in her UFC debut, or if you have Josie in this one as well. Big time slate of cards coming up and plenty of other prospects to look out for. So keep locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Couple of lightweight young guns looking to throw down coming up this weekend. It's like 2005-2006, Crosby versus Ovechkin. We have Ignacio Bahamondes representing Chile taking on China's Rong Zhu. And for both of these guys, you look at it. The lows have been low in the UFC. The highs have been very high. For Rong Zhu, loses his debut against Kazula Vargas, comes back and finishes Brandon Jenkins and looked amazing. And listen, he was getting ready for a Dakota Bush fight. It was going to be wrestling heavy. You get a Muay Thai striker and Brandon Jenkins, you drop him in the first round, you end up getting a finish. It was amazing. But the flip side, for Ignacio Bahamondes, you come in with all the shine, the flash, the flair, and you fight John McDessie, who's late in his career. He's a fun fighter. He's a bonus machine. He's coming off of a knee injury, a camp change. It was just a weird set of circumstances for John McDessie. And Ignacio Bahamondes, though he lost that fight by split decision, John McDessie won that fight. Holy smokes, let me tell you. So Bahamondes comes out his next time out against Roosevelt Roberts, and in that fight ends up with a knockout of the year contender. So now we're here. We get these two guys, but this is where the comparison from Crosby and Ovechkin kind of goes away. Neither one of these guys have tree trunk thighs like Sidney Crosby, and I hope, I swear and I hope.
It's weird you know how big Sidney Crosby's thighs are.
That's why he's so good at pivoting and having those defensive hips in
hockey. Defend it however you want.
And when it comes to this overall fight, I hope that neither one of these guys are like Alex Ovechkin in the corner, because they better not be chugging Coca-Cola in their water bottles. That's a gangster move.
It is.
You can be an all-timer that way, but it doesn't work in MMA. So Matt, when it comes to the way that this fight is fought, Rong Zhu, incredibly well-rounded. He'll give one to take one. You want to see one of his fights where it goes that way? Go watch his fight against Shai Yilan before he came into the UFC. And that was a really fun one. He eats a big shot, gives one right back, ends up getting the finish. But for Rong Zhu, he's a couple weeks away from his 22nd birthday, and he's 18-4 already in MMA. The comeback on Ignacio Bahamondes, I mean, a 2014 national champion in kickboxing. His father was a pro kickboxer. He moved to Chicago at a young age. He's a VFS Academy guy. Champion Juliana Pena's there. You also have Bilal Muhammad there. But for Bahamondes, the crazy thing is, he's 6'3", and he has a giant reach advantage in this fight. But here's the biggest takeaway I have on this fight. Rong Zhu, not the tallest guy at lightweight, but he fights really well at distance. But if you look at it for Ignacio Bahamondes, his bread gets buttered at mid-range and in the boxing range, and that's weird for a long-rangey kickboxer, you would think.
It is, but I really do think it comes down to volume when you're fighting a guy like Bahamondes, and I do think that that's a little bit more important than the range, because for John McDessie, he had a lot of success on the inside with Bahamondes. The thing was, though, he was constantly putting the jab on him, constantly putting the jab on him. You go back and look at Bahamondes' face, he looks like he got hit by a train. Not many guys' faces like puff up like that when they fight someone like John McDessie, because McDessie's not the most heavy-handed guy in the world. But even if McDessie jabs you 70 times, your face is going to start to bust up from that. And I do think that that's the important thing. That's really going to be the story of this fight. If Rong Zhu can stay in the face of Bahamondes and have sustained damaging attacks, attacks. And listen, the jab isn't going to win you the fight by knockout, but it's one of those things, it's steady. It wins rounds, not always fights. And the thing about Rong Zhu is that I think on the feet he can have some success doing that, but I really think he's going to struggle at kicking range, be it in close and at distance. Because for Bahamondes, he has really good lead leg kicks with that front leg. He's good at going to the body, good at going to the legs as well. And I do think that those are the type of attacks that can at least stifle some of what Rong Zhu does at distance. Again, I could be wrong, because with these fights where it does come down to the longer fighter fighting the shorter fighter, it really is sort of one-way traffic. Either the shorter fighter gets on the inside, causes a lot of damage, you can use the rest, or the long distance fighter can use their range. The thing about Bahamondes is when he gets the uppercuts going early, he goes to that well a lot. Like, I mean a lot. And it's one of those things that if he fights someone with really high fight IQ, let's say he fought like Dustin Poirier, and I understand he's had 2 fights in the UFC, that's a big jump. But someone like that who can read your strikes in the feet and then counter, it would cost him. But against someone like Rong Zhu, I do think that that's going to pay off a lot, because when Rong Zhu's coming in, when he's trying to use his forward momentum, those are attacks that are going to meet him a lot during this fight. And I do think that those are going to be things that are sustainable, along with the leg kick and along with the body kick of Bahamondes. The interesting part of this fight, though, is do you think the wrestling of Rong Zhu is going to play a factor? Be it either just to get on the inside with his range or for an actual takedown sense.
Well, this is kind of the craziest part about it, because Ignacio Bahamondes, numbers-wise, has 100% takedown defense in the UFC. John McDessie went 0-4. Roosevelt Roberts went 0-12. That's not good. So Bahamondes has been proficient that way. Obviously, with taller guys, they're harder to take down. Like, really taller guys. Because he has, what, a 6-inch height advantage in this fight? And if you look at it for Rong Zhu, he's always backing fighters up. That's the big thing that you like to see. A guy that backs you up, a guy that throws a nice 1-2, he can whip in a kick, and then mix in his wrestling. I mean, who knows what could happen? You love to see it, especially out of a prospect that's not even 22 years old yet, especially getting the win that he got his last time out. Now, Brandon Jenkins is Brandon Jenkins, and you have to kind of temper your expectations a little bit that way. But when I do look at this, I mean, Rong Zhu's first fight was at 16. Ignacio Bahamondes is 35-0-1 as an amateur kickboxer. Now, how good of... Because I didn't say this in the Ramona Pascual fight, but I just want to say this right now. She's 6-1 in Muay Thai over in Asia, and I went back and I watched some of her Muay Thai fights. There's a reason why she's so good at knees in MMA.
Yeah.
But I watched the people she was fighting. They were bad. They
were
awful.
This is why I might sometimes get upset when you say Mark Striegel's a Sambo master. Or Stephanie Egger, to her credit, looked good with her judo this weekend. But still, when she's a judo master, like, when people are 7-time world kickboxing champions in these certain organizations, you have to do a bit of a deep dive. Like, Joseph Baltolini said something that's always going to stay in my mind. Joe Rogan was trying to pump the kickboxing tires of Wonderboy Thompson. He's like, oh, he's 57-0. And Baltolini's like, well, wait, we're around the same age. We're around the same size. If he's that good at kickboxing, why did we never fight? And why have I never heard about him on the kickboxing scene? And then you're like, oh, wait. There are levels to, like, world kickboxing titles. Like, if you're not fighting in glory, I don't necessarily take your world title to the same level as another. I do think that's an important distinction that you bring up.
So we look at this fight, and Rong Zhu, I will say this, against Kazula Vargas, he was a minus 235 favorite. He lost that fight. He was a minus 210 or thereabouts in his last time out against Jenkins. He's a plus 210 in this fight. So you went from being a big favorite in your last two to a big underdog in this one. Ignacio Bahamondes somewhere around a minus 250 coming up on Saturday. If we have a look at the votes on Tapology, I'm going to say over-under on the viral knockout star of 75% Bahamondes. What would you say?
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over. They are slightly over. 634 total votes. 82% Bahamondes. 69% by decision. 18% that have Rong Zhu. 63% by decision. So a lot of people seeing this one going to a decision. Can Bahamondes throw enough volume then to get the win? I guess that really is the question. Because again, he does love the lead uppercut. It's not something that you see all that often. Lead uppercuts, you don't. Especially from, again, a long-rangey striker, you would assume, who fights better in the pocket. So I'm really eager to see this one. I also wonder if Rong Zhu starts to back Bahamondes up. He's not a guy that's going to come in all the time on a center line. He does like to move side to side quite a bit. Rong Zhu has really good footwork. So
here's the problem, though. Level of competition really, really does matter. And Ignacio Bahamondes, throughout his career, has faced a much tougher level of competition, I would say. I really do believe so. And I do think that's going to be a big part to play in this fight. Because both guys are young in their careers. But with Bahamondes, He's fought some tough guys. Like, even John McDessie as a UFC debut is a tough guy to face. And I do think he learned quite a bit from that fight going into the Roberts one. I do think he's improved a lot since then. And that's why I like Bahamondes. And that's why I do think the odds are a little shifted towards him. That's all.
I mean, I gotta be honest. Like, if you wanted to go with an underdog in this card, I don't think a sprinkle on Rung Zhu is the worst opportunity. Because I'm 50-50 on this fight. I have Bahamondes today. I'm eager to see these guys weigh in on Friday, get the opportunity to talk about the fight on Question Mark Kicks. When's that?
Saturday, 2 hours before the fights.
Exactly, 2 hours before the prelims. But I do like Rung Zhu in the aspect of, oh, by the way, he can also mix in the wrestling. Nobody's been able to take Bahamondes down out of the two fights he's had in the UFC. But how would he make out against a guy like Rung Zhu? Because at 170 against Preston Parsons, who's also in the UFC now, he did lose by first-round armbar, albeit early on in his career, but still, there is a possibility there. And Rung Zhu's top game and his top pressure and his ground and pound is very good. So for both of us right now, going with Chile's La Jaula, means the cage, we're going with Ignacio Bahamondes to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section if you have the PI in Shanghai's own. He trains an American top team now. It's Rung Zhu. Or if you have VFS's own Bahamondes. We have a big time card coming up this weekend. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
And a big-time welcome to the UFC for the Armenian-Italian superstar Armen Petrosian, a guy who's 70-21-1 as a kickboxer, brother of Giorgio Petrosian. I'm sorry, Bill? Bill in the control room? Bill with the cue cards? No, that's wrong. It's not that Armen Petrosian? No, silly goose. The UFC has an Armen Petrosian, but it's not the one that you know or I know or anybody else knows. No, it is the former AMC Fight Night light heavyweight champion Armen Petrosian. Superman never made any money, saving the world from Solomon Grundy, but I can tell you what he did. Came in on short notice on Dana White's Contender Series this past summer, knocked a man dead in the first round, and it was amazing. Armen Petrosian has power, and I absolutely love watching his fights. It was a pleasure and a treat going back, watching the fight tape for this one. Taking on a guy in Gregory Rodriguez, who, oh, by the way, also has wicked power in his hands. The only difference between these two guys from a striking perspective, and I'm really boiling it down, is the fact that Armen Petrosian throws great kicks, and Gregory Rodriguez throws no kicks. So that could be a big difference maker. Obviously, the big talking point for Gregory Rodriguez is the fact that we haven't really been able to see his ground game and his jiu-jitsu in the UFC, and that could ultimately be the best part of his game. But I have this to say, his boxing's damn good. When he came in and made his debut on short notice against Dusko Todorovic, he looked really good in that decision win. He looked great his last time out. He was able to pick a big-time win against Jun Young Park in a fight that, if I'm not mistaken, we both had Jun Young Park in that one.
He busted him up.
And they gave him a fight of the night bonus, even though David Onama, Mason Jones is pretty good on that card too. But for Gregory Rodriguez, since getting knocked out in the first round against scrappy old Jordan Williams back a year and 4 months ago, he beat Almadovao, that was on Dana White's Contender Series at a point. He beat Josh Fremd, who's now in the UFC, just got signed recently. He finished him quickly and won the LFA championship over there. Again, Todorovic, and then his last time out, a big win. But I look at it for Armen Petrosian, and this guy is interesting because you look at the level of competition. It's not the best, but it's not that bad. And then you look at it, he wins the AMC Fight Night light heavyweight title. Again, knockout, 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 knockout. He loses to Hassan Youssefi, who is a really good fighter. You do a deep dive on his career. He is a very, very accomplished fighter. Loses that one in the first round back in June of last year. But then a month and about a week later, he gets another fight, and he wins that one by knockout. And then 3 months later, he comes in on short notice to take on Kaloyan Kolev. And in that fight, if you look at it for Petrosian, he was a slight favorite, which kind of surprised me because he was, what, 5-1 going into that fight or 6-1 going into that fight? He ultimately gets the win there. But, Matt, again, this fight, striker's paradise, I would say.
I don't think this fight's going to go to decision. Now, I said that about Joaquin Buckley and Abdulrazak Alhassan, and that went to a decision. Now, both guys got rocked quite a few times in that fight, so it could have been ended, but still, I don't think this fight's going to go to a decision for these reasons. Petrosian is a good striker. But he doesn't plant his feet at all. Like, you didn't set this fight up very well. Whereas Rodriguez, very plodding forward kind of a style, will use his combinations. Good uppercuts from Rodriguez, too. If guys do have a very high guard, he's good at finding holes in it, good at using his hooks to go around, and uppercuts to go up the middle, too. And I really like the body workout of Rodriguez, too. Not something we see as often as I'd like. He's not like a Shane Burgos who will go in with the intent of throwing 3-4 hooks to the body. But when Rodriguez does mix in his body hooks and then follow them up with head attacks, it is lethal. Like, there's few guys who can eat that kind of power in this division, but that's why I think this is sort of strange matchmaking. Like, Rodriguez is on a UFC win streak right now. He has wins at the UFC level, and a number of them at this point. It is odd that they're giving Petrosian, I don't want to say this high profile of an opponent, because let's be honest, Gregory Rodriguez isn't a show-stopping talent by any means, but still, he's at least a proven guy in the UFC, and that's why I'm surprised they're giving Petrosian this opportunity. I understand stylistically, he does have a great opportunity to win. Two natural strikers who throw very heavy shots, anyone could win. I just think it's a really big step up in competition to go from Contender Series 2 Gregory Rodriguez, who's won multiple fights by knockout recently.
This is the thing that scares me about this fight. Armin Petrosian has a mix of speed and power that you love to see at middleweight. It makes middleweight exciting. He called out, Adesanya after he won that fight.
Which, and then come on now.
It seemed like Adesanya was willing to engage in at least a conversation. So I do like Armin Petrosian, but again, for Rodriguez, will I ever see the ground game? Because I can't wait for it. And I think this might be the fight, because if you look at it for the man himself, Armin Petrosian, he is a kickboxing and Muay Thai champ. He has a karate background. He's a black belt in karate. I mean, he's training at American Top Team just down the road from Sanford MMA, where Gregory Rodriguez is right now, with Ali Askab Hizriev, Gleison Tibau, Magomed Karimov, Gleison Tibau. He has a win over Rory McDonald. That's a real thing. That happened. But again, when I do look at it, it really is weird, because if you look at it for Gregory, 3 of 5 on takedown attempts against Dusko Todorovic, 2 of 4 against Jun Young Park. For Armin Petrosian, taken down. He's taken down 3 times on his fight on Dana White's Contender Series before it got back up to the feet, and he had the, you know, kind of the jitters to get to that strike, really try and finish the fight, and he did. So I can see Petrosian. He's like one of those guys, like, the floor is lava, and if I touch the mat, I gotta get back up. And he does have a good first move to try and get back off. But if you get held down, it could be bad. On the flip side, speed and power, Gregory doesn't throw kicks. He does not tend to throw kicks, and he is very much a plodding forward boxer, like you said. Armin Petrosian has the legs and the body wide open. Now, could Gregory grab one, take him down? Very much possibility. So if we look at the odds for this one, Rodriguez open a minus 200 favorite. He's a minus 179 or thereabouts right now on best fight odds. For Petrosian, open a plus 170, plus 150 thereabouts right now. So again, you talk about a guy UFC level, on a UFC level win streak, 4-fight win streak for Rodriguez. I'm going to say over under 62.5% Rodriguez.
I think they should be over if they're not.
Thinking they should, they are over. 627 total votes, 79% Rodriguez, 70% by knockout. For the 21% that have Petrosian, 78% by knockout. So Matt, the fans are thinking knockout. What are you thinking in this fight? Because I know you said you expect it to not go the distance.
Like, Gregory Rodriguez knocked out a good UFC fighter in his last fight. That's not a controversial thing to say. That is a known fact. Now he's fighting somebody who, let's say you want to sell or you want to buy the best package of Petrosian, then maybe he can make it 50-50 on the feet, and he's at a massive detriment on the ground. That's kind of the way I look at this fight, because he does have kicks, but the problem is it's hard to throw kicks when you're being pressured. You can't throw kicks when you're moving backwards, and Gregory Rodriguez never stops moving forward. Unless you hit him with a really big shot early on like Jordan Williams was able to do, I don't think Petrosian's going to be able to have sustained success on the feet against Rodriguez. And I do think we're going to see some takedown attempts throughout this fight. It's probably going to be Rodriguez taking down Petrosian. I just don't think I've given Gregory Rodriguez the respect he deserves throughout his UFC run, and I'm not going to do that anymore, so I'm going to pick him in this fight.
I think if Gregory Rodriguez strikes against Armin Petrosian, he's going to get knocked out. I like Rodriguez in this fight because he has to work in his takedowns, but this is just like last weekend's Jessica Rose Clark, Stephanie Egger. We got shredded in the comments section. You guys didn't watch ADCC. You don't know what you're talking about.
I said if she wins, it's going to be by armbar.
And I said if Jessica Rose Clark decides to grapple, it's the biggest mistake. And those things happen. I think if Gregory Rodriguez goes out there, We're going to strike against Armin Petrosian, he's going to get lit up. Because again, Armin Petrosian, for what it's worth, is also an IFMA Muay Thai champ, to go with the karate black belt, to go with the Muay Thai and the kickboxing record that he has. just go back and watch his fights. It is a pleasure to go back and watch it. But both of us in this one going with Brazil's Gregory Rodriguez, going with the unknown of the ground game, but we do know that the wrestling is there for him. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Do you have Armenia's Armin Petrosian, who before his last fight against Kolev was said to have gone to Dagestan to try and work his wrestling, and now he's an American top team with some guys from Dagestan? We'll see how this one plays out. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, we have a couple of guys that are in that Hansel zone.
Hansel, so hot right now.
Both defeated in their UFC debut. Since then, tidy 4-fight win streaks. And for Joel Alvarez, I mean, he's been finishing guys left, right, and center. In his last fight, he was a giant underdog against Thiago Moises. And he came out and did something I've never seen of Joel Alvarez in the UFC, because normally he's on the defensive. He gets backed up. He gets taken down. He has defensive submissions. He ends up getting guys finished. But if you look at it, I mean, even Danilo Belluardo was able to try and implement his wrestling. Joe Duffy was trying to be offensive. Alexander Yakovlev tried. Thiago Moises didn't. Because in that fight, Joel Alvarez, I know we talked about it pre-fight, like you go over to his Instagram and he's wearing boxing gloves and he's training and striking, but sometimes that's either to a huge benefit or a giant detriment. And for a guy like Joel Alvarez, who has so many submission wins, it was a little bit of a mind pretzel when I went and looked at that. And then you go look at his last fight out. He's throwing knees up the middle, he's throwing teep kicks from distance, and when it comes into the clinch, he's throwing short elbows and knocking Thiago Moises down and dirty. And then after it, he said, "Thank you, pal."
It was cute. Tender moment in the cage.
Rest easy, sweet prince. So for Joel Alvarez, amazing performances, but I have this to say. In his last two fights, as good as they were, you look at it against Yakovlev and Thiago Moises, he weighed in at 157.5 against Yakovlev and 159.5. Hey, Yoel.
Do you think he's a member of the Thick Boy Bike Club?
Shut shut the front door. I don't care about that. I do care.
But he's a thick boy because he missed weight, Craig. Come
on. Don't reference that stuff. I think that he needs to make the weight. That's ultimately a big point because he had a giant launch pad in his last fight against Thiago Moises. I mean, think about it. Joel Alvarez was able to finish Moises in the first round. Fourth ranked UFC lightweight right now, Islam Makhachev, couldn't get a finish over Thiago Moises and had a 5-round decision against
him. He armbarred him. He beat him in the fourth round.
He looked really good. Sorry. It was later on. Alvarez was able to get it done earlier on. My point being, Joel Alvarez had a great opportunity in that one. For Armin Tsarukyan, he had a great opportunity in his UFC debut, and he had a competitive fight against your fourth ranked lightweight, Islam Makhachev. And since then, if you look at it for Tsarukyan, 3 straight decision wins over Olivier Aubin-Mercier, Davi Hamosh, Matt Frivola, and then his finish his last time out against Christos Yagos. You definitely love the way that Armin Tsarukyan's training at this point, because I feel like Tsarukyan coming into the UFC, everybody was very high on him. It was an opportunity where you lose the fight, you don't lose a whole lot of stock. Just like David Onama when he fought Mason Jones, to David Onama finishing Gabriel Benitez last weekend. Whereas for Joel Alvarez, man, he had a pumped record, a padded record coming into the UFC. He loses to Demir Ismagulov, who, don't get me wrong, Demir's a great fighter. You watch that fight, Demir's all over him. It wasn't even close. Joel had no opportunity at any level of that fight. But since then, he's been finishing steadily increasing competition all the way up to Thiago Moises, who, I don't know if it was an off night for Moises, but I got to give Alvarez his flowers. His striking was so improved. His offensive game was so improved. I have a comparison that I'll give a little bit later on. But what do you think about this one?
I think this is a phenomenal fight. And it's really interesting, too, because like you said, two very high-level prospects, two guys who, we get a lot of these like, oh, two people making their UFC debut. One's probably going to have a good career. One might only be a one and done. No matter who wins or loses this fight, they're still going to be around in the UFC. That's how high level these guys are. But like you said, Alvarez has improved his striking quite a bit, even in a short time in the UFC. And that's the really important thing, like you said. Padded record coming in, so you didn't really know what you were going to get. But I became a believer in the Joe Duffy fight. And I know Joe Duffy, he's a little up, he's a little bit down. But you know what you're going to get with Duffy. Really good jiu-jitsu and a really good boxing base, too. Alvarez is able to really frustrate him on the feet. And defensive submissions for the longest time were Joel Alvarez's bread and butter. He would maybe not always hurt guys in the feet, but frustrate them enough so that they would become wrestlers and then he would submit them with his great jiu-jitsu. I don't think he's going to be able to submit Armin Tsarukyan, though. And I know I've had these kind of maybe red flags or hot takes where, oh, Muniz or Andre Muniz won't submit to Jacare Souza. And of course it happens. But I look at the grappling of Armin Tsarukyan, and he's just so technically sound. He's not a guy who leaves his head in bad positions. He's someone who will chain together multiple takedown attempts, trying to get the perfect entry, and then he will execute on that. I think that's going to help him avoid a lot of the big submission attempts, or at least the big actions of Joel Alvarez that might help him finish the fight. Because this is how I look at this fight. Let's say you have like a My Career in 2K or NFL or anything. You can either be a really well-rounded character, sort of put skills all over the place. That's sort of what I look at with Armin Tsarukyan. A good boxer, has good submissions, really good wrestling, of course, that's his specialty. But he's well-rounded across the board. Whereas with Alvarez, he put all of his points into finishing. Like, his cardio's a little questionable, he's a little hittable on the feet. But if you go to the mat with him, he's going to choke you unconscious. And if he can start going downhill with his combinations, he's very dangerous on the feet. But I guess this is where I'll hand it back off to you. With Joel Alvarez and his striking, to me, it's very feast or famine. Do you think he will have a lot of success in this fight on the feet with Tsarukyan? Or do you think he's almost going to have to dry out the takedown attempts of Armin to make this more of a grappling match?
This is the one where somebody's listening on an airplane. They're going to get mad. They're going to hammer their car seat. They're going to say, oh, you guys, don't go off on a tangent like that. Just hear me out. Joel Alvarez can strike, but he's primarily known as a submission artist. If you watch Bellator 274 in the main event this past weekend, Logan Storley, all he does is wrestle. It's all he knows. He had a competitive fight against the champion Yaroslav Amosov. Some say he won that
fight. They wrestled.
But mainly, all he does is wrestle. He's positioned over anything. It's like watching a Jake Shields. It always was for the majority of his career. He trains at Sanford MMA, and that's where I'm going with this one. Neiman Gracie is, and always was, a submission guy. His striking's not good at all. But Neiman Gracie went out and fought Mark Leminger, who's a good wrestler, and he can get it done on the feet. And Neiman Gracie looked like a polished striker, like he's been a kickboxer his whole life. Is that Joel Alvarez? Is that what we got against Thiago Moises? Because I've never seen Joel Alvarez that offensive and not good with his striking to the fact where he kept landing. Moises goes down. His forehead's completely cut open.
Like, bad.
So I look at that performance out of Neiman Gracie against Leminger, Joel Alvarez against Moises, and then I look at Gracie against Storley. They went out there and struck for 5 rounds, and Logan Storley looked like a world-class boxer, and Neiman Gracie looked like he had never struck in his life again. So it really was a tale of two different fights, and Logan Storley's not known as this thunderous boxer. He looked amazing in that fight. The Robbie Lawler corner, the Sanford MMA guy. So I'm eager to see what Joel Alvarez looks like coming out of a camp. He's still over in Spain. Armin Tsarukyan kind of training all over the place. Looks like this camp was in Russia. You see it in the graphic there. Obviously, he was born in Georgia, grew up in Armenia. He spends time in Russia. So it is interesting that way. But when I do look at this fight, that is the thing. I mean, is Joel Alvarez going to have his kiss him on the forehead moment or kiss him on top of the head moment once more? Armin Tsarukyan, obviously, with the wrestling, with everything he can bring together, the pitter-patter in and out, that is what makes it interesting. But Matt, I look at the odds, and what I could find, best fight odds is weird. There's nothing on Tapology. I did find an average in future fights on best fight odds. Tsarukyan opened a minus 175. He's a minus 313 right now. Alvarez opened a plus 150. He's a plus 243. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, I know, again, people are down on Alvarez based on the weight, but high on the performances. But everybody's been high on Armin Tsarukyan for a long time. I'm going to say over under 77.5% Tsarukyan.
I think they'll be under. I think they'll be closer to 50.
They are closer. 706 total votes, 62% Tsarukyan, 79% by decision for the 38% that have Alvarez, 59% by knockout. Samat, we talked up both of these guys. We talked up their games, their camps, their averages, like what we've seen so far. What's the final pick here for you?
If someone's going to win by finish, it's going to be Joel Alvarez. And that's not a hot take, of course. Like, look at his record. He only wins by stoppage, which is incredible. Like, that's something he should be commended for. But Armin is the much steadier fighter. And later on in the fight, I know exactly what I'm going to get from Tsarukyan. He's still going to be able to shoot a lot of takedowns. And his striking has been improved. This is the comp I was going to say. Armin Tsarukyan is like Corey Anderson with a way better PR team around him. He was a boring fighter who did use a lot of his wrestling. Let's just call it what it is. But in his last fight, similar to Anderson against Johnny Walker, He went out there and destroyed Christos Yagos, who was a step up in competition.
In the first round.
In the first round. It looked really good. But I will admit, that could be another situation of, you looked really good in your last fight and you're striking, but we haven't really seen it be sustainable throughout your career. That's why I do think this fight on the feet will be very interesting, because we know how good Alvarez is on the mat. We know how good Tsarukyan is on the mat. It's the striking where the question marks really do lie. But for me, I think I'm going to pick Armin Tsarukyan in this one. I think he's the more steady guy with his wrestling. And if he is able to tire out Joel Alvarez, avoid some of the submission ability of Alvarez, and make Alvarez feel his overall physicality, I think Tsarukyan can win a decision.
When I look at implied probabilities, you go past the minus 250, minus 275, you're up around minus 300. We're talking about an 80% chance that Armin Tsarukyan wins. And for me, I don't necessarily see that. So for that reason, I like Joel Alvarez. I love the shots to the body that he does employ, and I absolutely love the calf kick that he has. Now, Tsarukyan can switch stances, can mix in the wrestling, but I think at a certain point, you're starting to mix in the wrestling. Obviously, with Alvarez, it is something that you want to try and avoid. We've seen wrestlers have success against Brazilian jiu-jitsu artists, but I do like Joel Alvarez, and yes, do I think it's a little bit of a case study, that one fight that he had against Thiago Moises? Sure, sure, 100%. He did have success, like you said, against Joe Duffy. But I do like the striking of Alvarez in this fight, just as long as he makes the damn weight on Friday. So we'll be eager to see that one and how it plays in on question mark kicks. But split on the pick on this one.
I just don't put a lot of stock into implied win probability. That's all. Like, Tsarukyan is the favorite that he is, and that's fine. I just think it comes down to his wrestling more than anything.
I'm going with the underdog in this one. Out of Spain, Joel Alvarez to get the win. Matt going with Armin Tsarukyan. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this battle of rising lightweight prospects. And hey, I mean, you know, guys had 21 fights and the other guys had 19. Hard to call them a prospect, but they're exciting guys to watch nonetheless. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
A confusing loser leaves town fight on the main card of this weekend's UFC Fight Night Makhachev versus Green. We have South Korea's Firefist Jeon Kim taking on Brazil's zombie girl Priscilla Cachoeira, and I won't sell wolf tickets on this fight one bit. Jeon Kim is 9-4-2, and if you look at the averages in terms of the odds, she's a minus 186 favorite. In the UFC, she has 3 wins, she has 4 losses. Let's talk about the wins. A split decision win over Justine Kish, who is no longer with the promotion. She just had her first fight with Bellator.
Pooped herself in the cage.
A split decision win over Melinda Fabian.
One of the worst fighters ever signed.
Not in the UFC for very long. And a knockout win over Nadia Kassim, who only had 2 fights in the UFC, got finished in both of them, got booked in a fight after the 2 knockout losses, didn't end up making the walk
to the
octagon. And got cut after that. But I look at the fights that she's had so far, and it's weird, right? Because, again, the losses. A loss to Lucia Pudzilova, Octagon Zone. A loss to Antonina Shevchenko, 30-27 on all the judges' scorecards. A loss to Alexa Grasso, where she actually looked better in that fight. She boxed, went strike for strike against Grasso. She loses the decision, but it was an entertaining
Grasso's
fight.
Good.
And then she lost to Molly McCann her last time out. Now, that was a fight of the night. And it was kind of weird. Like, in between, she was booked with Pollyanna Battaglio. She was booked with McCann, and then they rebooked it. And now we're here. So we're coming off of a fight against Alexa Grasso, who's somewhere in the top 15 of this flyweight division, even though she's pretty well a strawweight, but she's a flyweight now. And a loss to Molly McCann, who's like 15 to 20 on her best day. So it just really is a weird spot for Jeon Kim. And this is what makes it weirder. Again, I can sell wolf tickets on certain people.
Through the list?
No, but I can think of a lot of them. But when you look at the sum of the parts aren't equal to the whole fighter that we get, for Jeon Kim, former Deep Jewels Bantamweight champion, black belt in Wushu, black belt in Hapkido, BJJ purple belt, 11-2-1 amateur kickboxing record, 6-2 amateur boxing record, 3-0 in amateur MMA, and she's 9-4-2. Like, this should be the hottest fighter ever. Now, she used to train forever at Mob Training Center over in South Korea. This is her second full camp at Syndicate, and it seems like she's in everybody's Instagram story. Like, she's hanging out with everybody at the gym. We have another fighter from Syndicate on this weekend's card, making her UFC debut to Hong Kong, and Ramona Pasquale. But again, when it comes to this fight, Jeon Kim, I love her counter-striking. I love her volume. I love her footwork. I don't love her head movement because it never moves. She gets hit a lot. And she gets backed up a lot. And her defensive wrestling's not that bad.
That's what I'm going to say. I don't like her foot movement because she moves too much. She moves left to right too much. She's never in the pocket, and that's what concerns me about Jihyun Kim. When she strikes, it's a lot of, my feet are always moving, and I'm never really stationary. And when you're striking like that, you have no pop in your shots. I understand she got TKO whenever Nadia casts him. I don't care about that whatsoever. Nadia's not la creme de la creme by any means. But when you look at Priscilla Cachoeira, I always go back to the Lose Yourself lyric by Eminem. To trap bombs, but she keeps on forgetting. And not for her, she doesn't forget what she wrote down. She just forgets defensive grappling in every single fight, no matter who she's fighting. Like, when you get out-grappled by Molly McCann, I start to have some serious concerns. If you get out-struck by her, okay, she's a pretty good boxer. But Molly McCann went in there and completely out-wrestled Priscilla Cachoeira. And this isn't me taking away from Molly McCann, but it's more to say, styles make fights, and when you look at that fight on paper, it's wow, Cachoeira and McCann, they're just gonna go back and forth on the feet. Cachoeira got convincingly out-grappled by Molly McCann, and ever since, it's been a massive hole in her game. It has never been something that she's fixed, and I gotta be honest, Craig, after she had her two wins by knockout, yes, she looked good. Knocked out Gina Mazzani, I know I got excited. I even had her to beat Jillian Robertson. I'm surprised they're giving her another chance after what she did in that Jillian Robertson fight.
It was an accident.
Because I like my eyes where they are, you know, in my head.
I didn't mean to do it.
Yeah, and Priscilla was like, I'm just going to go four fingers deep in both of your eyes and try to pull them out. Like, that's some genuinely dirty stuff that has no defense whatsoever for it. And I know
it was an accident.
But it wasn't. And I know Li Xingliang got away with that against Jake Matthews, and they gave him another chance. But Li Xingliang at least is a very, very talented fighter at the end of the day. So if you want to spin it a certain way and say, okay, he made a mistake, that's fine. But Priscilla's not like a showstopper, like, hey, cancel your Saturday night plans. Priscilla Cachoeira is fighting. I'm just surprised they're giving her an opportunity after doing such an egregious foul roll her last time out.
But what about on the main card? Is that a good place? Like, I just look at this, and the craziest part about it, I went back and did a lot of tape study on both of these fighters. And obviously, Priscilla Cachoeira, if you just look at numbers on a page on UFC stats, her strike differential is still slightly negative. It used to be really negative. It's just because of the Mero Yamasaki-Valentina Shevchenko fight.
I want her to be a warrior.
A fight that never should have happened, ever. But it did. So I look at that, and then I look at Jihyun Kim. Her last fight against Molly McCann. 10-inch reach advantage, and I talked about this earlier on this card. Ignacio Bahamondes is a guy that's bigger than just about any other lightweight he's going to fight until he sees Joel Alvarez, and they do this, like the Spider-Man meme, because they're both the same size. But for Jihyun Kim, 10-inch reach advantage against Molly McCann, and like Bahamondes, they like to strike in the mid-range and in boxing range, and that's really weird. Kim waits to bait her opponent in, slip to the left, throw the left hook, and then maybe slip back to the right. Like, that's the thing.
She like, stumbles around a bunch and then re-engages. It's a very odd striking style.
There is one point. It's in the first round against Molly McCann. She gets hit, then she hits back, and then she turns her back to McCann and runs the other way. It's the weirdest thing ever. So, again, I look at this fight as Jihyun Kim has everything that you want to see out of a successful fighter. A former champion with another organization. Good experience against good opponents. Priscilla's taking on the champ, but there's that. But when it comes to Jihyun Kim, much more well-rounded. Does not kick.
Jihyun Kim's kind of like cleated out an old Fraser. Like, all of her accolades are way at the back, but there's a lot of stuff you got to get through before you get to those accolades. Like, with Jihyun Kim, because I agree 100%, her grappling should say that she goes in there and submits a lot of people. Her striking would suggest that she is a knockout artist. Like, you look at her accolades on a piece of paper, and you assume that she's going to challenge Valentina Shevchenko next week. And then you actually watch it in effect in the cage, and it's nothing that was advertised.
Matt told us that Jihyun Kim wasn't UFC caliber. I went back and watched our last video against Molly McCann.
I still defend that point.
Less than 10% of her strikes in the UFC have been to the legs. For Priscilla Cachoeira, she's got a jab and an overhand right, and she's scrappy. I mean, honest to goodness, like, what else can I tell you about her? Like, if you go and look at those two wins in the UFC, Shayna Dobson, they just go at it.
A gym teacher.
First one to drop. And then in her fight against Gina Mazzani, she loses the first round handily, and Gina's got nothing left at the tank, down a weight class from where she normally is, and Priscilla's able to just take over from there and gets a standing TKO. Like, yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Lit her out.
So when I look at the odds for this one, Kim open a minus 200. She's a minus 186 right now. Priscilla Cachoeira open a plus 170. She's plus 135. Matt, over under, I'm going to say Jihyun Kim, 60% on the Tapology votes. What are you saying?
I think Cachoeira should be the favorite. Nope.
603 total votes, 66% Kim, 89% by decision for the 34% that I've catch Hueda, 72% by decision. I will say this. Jiyeon Kim throws a lot more of everything.
She does volume.
And she might not have the best striking defense, but she has an odd chin. I like Jiyeon Kim in this fight because I think she can keep a sustained pace for three rounds. Priscilla Cachueta just throws power shots.
That's it. But when they land, they're devastating. That is the one thing we have to give her credit for. I'll also pick Jiyeon Kim. I don't love the pick, if I'm being honest. Again, Priscilla Cachueta is one of the few women who can go out there and genuinely get TKO victories. Like, she has really, really nice power in her hands. But I do think Kim has the better variety of shots. I do think her footwork, although I don't like it, if we're being completely honest, I think it will be enough for her to evade the power shots of Cachueta. And she'll be able to win probably an unappealing 29-28 decision.
Most likely the winner of this fight will fight a fighter who walked out to one of my favorite songs their last time out, Living Dead Girl. It was Cast Iron Courtney Casey. But both of us in this fight going with Syndicate MMA Zone. Jiyeon Kim to get the win. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Can Priscilla Cachueta make it a storm? Not weather a storm, make it a storm and get the win. Again, let us know for better or for worse down in that comments section. Couple big fights left on this card. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say,
let's get into it.
Do or die in another co-main event at middleweight between unranked middleweights. The UFC loves this. We have Misha Cirkunov taking on Wellington Turman. And in this fight, for the Prodigy, I mean, it's been a bad ride. Like, listen, we're BJ Penn levels of bad at this point for the Prodigy, and I'm not even talking about BJ Penn. Wellington Turman has had a rough go, and I was promised a bill of goods, and I didn't really get it. I was promised a good grappler. I was promised a heavy striker. So let's have a look down through Wellington Turman's record.
Is this a three dressed up as a nine matchup?
I mean, April Wine references aside, yeah, he had a couple of wins over UFC level talent outside of the UFC.
You don't look like your profile pictures at all, Wellington Turman.
No, it's true. I mean, he had a loss to Carlson Harris, who lost to Shavkat Rakhmonov aside.
Oh, there's no shame to that.
Carlson Harris is a good fighter. But you look at it in the UFC. Wellington Turman fights Carl Roberson in a fight where didn't think Carl was going to perform as well as Carl did. And yeah, it's a split decision. But if you look at it for Wellington, like, you know, you're supposed to have a big grappling, you know, advantage. And he did take him down. He did attempt submissions. But Carl ultimately ends up the winner. So then he beats Marcus Perez. A good win. Marcus Perez. You win one, you lose one in the UFC. But a former LFA champ. Luis de Aldearte Sanchez gets knocked out in the first round by old karate style.
I was going to say, that was Danielson.
That was an NAIA wrestling champion, Sanchez. That was, for some reason, you know, Canadian TriStar superstar. Andrew Sanchez loses to Bruno Silva when they played touch butt in the park because they were former grappling partners, like, you know, Conor McGregor and a strength guy.
Is that how touch butt in the park ends?
Well, no.
Come on, I know, but just like touch butt in the park would suggest the fight was like Sean Strickland versus Jack Hermanson, you know, a light sparring matchup. I didn't think Wellington Turman was going to wake up after he fought Bruno Silva.
No, but it was like, oh, we're buddies. We used to grapple before. We're going to have a good time. And then Bruno decided.
Oh, my God.
I'm Blindado, and we're Blindadoing out of here. So Bruno gets a big win there. My guy, my future champ, Bruno Silva. But if you look at it for Wellington's last time out, you might be down on the fact that he beat Sam Alvey by split decision, but go back piece by piece and watch that fight. Because really, Wellington won all three rounds of that fight. He won it handily, but he kept poking his hands out there. And in the third round, he gets 2 points deducted by referee War Tione, Chris Tione. And ultimately, the judges scored that contest. I'm not making this up. 28-27 for Alvey by Adelaide Bird. 28-27 and 28-27 by Derek Cleary and Ron McCarthy for Turman. You don't often see scores like that. So that should clear up that split decision because Wellington Turman did get the win. Sam Alvey had the opportunity if he was able to get all the points in the third round, get a draw. But he didn't. For some reason, Adelaide Bird was just off in space. I will say this.
Not the first time.
I'm dead serious. She's been more bang on with her judging since she's kind of come back this year and last.
Also, Gennady Golovkin Canelo 3, I think, has been announced. So that's exciting.
But when we focus in on this fight, Wellington Turman, he has a little bit of volume on the feet, but not a lot of power. When it's on the ground, he has good jiu-jitsu, but bad takedown defense. He's taking on Misha Cirkunov, who at one point was Toronto's biggest star. I mean, this guy was just snatching things up left,
Austin
right, and center.
Matthews?
But you look at it, well, I'd say he's Arizona's biggest star. You look at his last five fights, this for Misha Serkinov. A win in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada over Pat Cummins. Quick arm triangle, very quick.
Pat Cummins was 38 years old.
A knockout loss to Johnny Walker that was disgusting. A submission win by Peruvian Necktie over Jimmy Crute that was back and forth. Like, the scrambles were crazy in that one. A loss to Ryan Spann at 205. And then he decided, I've never made 185 in my career. I better take on Christophe Jaco. He loses by split decision. But if you really look at that one, nobody scored that fight for Misha Serkinov.
Okay, I didn't know where you were going with this, and I was going to get really upset.
He did, in terms of total strikes, it was close. He also had five takedowns on Jaco, who just popped back up. But Misha Serkinov had one arm that had so much less mass than the other one, and he just looked drained at 185.
This is a really weird point, so hopefully people can follow along. You know how cheetahs are going extinct because they're, like, too specialized? Like, they only eat one thing, and they follow such a specific niche in nature.
Almost like a panda?
Just hear me out. That if the food chain breaks at all, cheetahs could go extinct tomorrow. But the thing is, they're really good at doing the thing they do, which is running in a straight line, killing gazelles. Misha Serkinov is kind of like a cheetah, where if everything goes the perfect way, if he gets on top of his opponent, if he can start using his submission ability, you're screwed and there's nothing you can do about it. Like, Jimmy Crute is as physical of a grappler as you can possibly get at 205 pounds, might I remind you. And when Misha Serkinov got him to the mat, he really just flowed with everything he did, got into a dominant position, and put the squeeze on him. Like, that was the best version of a Misha Serkinov performance. The flip side is, if he can't follow that very, very clear trajectory, he starts to run into issues. And I do think with Serkinov, maybe this is unfair to say, but it's almost like Russell Westbrook at the free throw line. I think he's in his own head when he's on the feet. He doesn't look very comfortable on the feet at this point in his career. And I don't know if it's because he knows, okay, if I don't get these takedowns, I have a bit of a sitting duck. So maybe let's conserve my energy a little bit more, because I know that, hey, if I'm tired, can't get the takedown, I'm screwed on the feet. Or maybe the flip side is, he just wants to conserve his energy more, because a lot of his submission wins do come early on in the fight. He is a bit of a fast starter. But against Wellington Turman, here's the thing. Wellington is a better striker than Misha Serkinov. Honestly, 95% of the roster probably is a better striker, pure striking-wise, than Serkinov. But the issue is, Turman's not the type of fighter who can just outstrike you for 15 minutes and win an MMA fight. He can, but he really does need the takedown at some point. And Misha Serkinov's the last guy you want to grapple with at all, because his only path to victory is, let him get close enough for him to put his hands around you. If you keep it just jab, 1-2, leg kick, make it boring on the outside, you can beat Misha Serkinov. Christophe Jaco proved that the last time out. But I don't think Wellington Turman will stick to that game plan. I think he has the tools to beat Serkinov, but I don't think he's going to follow that game plan. I do think at some point he's going to grapple with Serkinov, and we all kind of know what happens at that point.
It really is weird, because, I mean, Turman, for as long or as short of a time, depending on how you want to look at it, that he's been in the UFC, I mean, the guy's only 25. He's halfway between that and 26, and that could be the start of a rap song, Wellington Turman, halfway. Anyway, but he does train out of Teixeira MMA and Fitness. It'll be interesting to see, because he used to be out of Gilles Ribeiro team in Brazil. He's been at Teixeira for a bit. He was originally scheduled for a very different fight, and that is the really weird thing. So you look at it, Turman was booked versus Adolfo Vieira in the last couple of months.
Sort of a similar matchup.
That one fell out. Misha Serkinov was booked against Mahmoud Muradov, who fell out due to a hand injury. So, yeah, that would have been a comfortable one for Mahmoud, one would think. So I look at the odds for this one. Serkinov opened to minus 190s, minus 124 on best fight odds. For Turman, he opened to plus 165. It's plus 101 right now. If we look on Tapology for the total number of votes, I can understand everybody being down on both these guys. I mean, again, both are 2-3 in their last five. I would expect the loser to leave town. But if we're going to go Tapology votes, we're going to guess. I'm going to say over-under 57.5% Serkinov. What would you say?
I'll say under.
I'm going to say under. Way big over. 572 total votes. 81% Serkinov. 35% by decision. 52% by submission. For the 19% that have Turman, 64% by decision. So Matt, Serkinov was able to take Jaco down in his last fight, but Jaco was able to pop back up quite a bit. And pepper on the feet, it was a close enough fight. I do think that Jaco won going back and watching it. But when it comes to this one, Serkinov, second cut to 185 at what? A couple days from his, his 35th birthday? Like, what are you saying here at middleweight?
I don't like it, Craig. I don't like Serkanovic at 185 pounds because he just doesn't look that good weighing in. Like, he didn't look great his first time around, and it looked like it hurt his gas tank. And I understand Misha Serkanov's never been somebody who we talk about his cardio as being one of his big strengths, but still, it did look like he was depleted last time out. With that being said, though, I can't pick Wellington Turnbull. I don't. I just don't think he has the power to hurt Serkanov on the feet if it does stay there. I think he can outvolume him, and hey, if he wins by decision by outpointing Misha Serkanov on the feet, I can live with that as the result. I just think if that's your style, that gives Serkanov the opportunity to get a takedown at any point throughout any of the three rounds, and I do think that if he gets on top of Turnbull, he will at least be able to outgrapple him and hold him down. I know with Jaco he wasn't able to do that, but that's what Jaco's game is. I'm elusive on the feet, and when I get brought down, I pop back up to my feet. I think Turman's going to invite the grappling a little bit more, which will be to his detriment. So I'm going to pick Misha Serkanov, although I'm letting you know right now I don't love the pick.
I like Serkanov's leg kicks his last time out. He threw 18 or 19 of them total. It was a high percentage of his strikes, which is kind of interesting
because
he's not a giant leg kicker by any means, but I did like to see that in a fight against a kickboxer. That's nice, but as much as it pains me to say it, I like Brazil's underdog here in Wellington Turnbull. Between the M and the N, you don't have to carry the A with you all day, just Turnbull. But when it comes to Wellington, he's one of those tricky guys that I think he'll be able to pepper on the feet, he'll be able to defend some of those takedowns, and just stay the heck away. The mat is lava, you gotta stay away from it. And I think, at least training with a game plan with Glover Teixeira, I think that's a perfect guy to get ready with,
He did beat the brakes off Misha Serkanov when they fought, so you are right.
That much is true. So there's gonna be, another Spider-Man meme right there. Uh-oh. But both of us split on this pick. Matt going with Latvia's own, formerly of Toronto, Misha Serkanov. I've got Connecticut's own, Wellington Turnbull, to get the win. Really looking forward to this fight in another unranked middleweight co-main event. Ooh. Oh boy, the UFC, they're not doing us right. I will tell you what they are doing, though. They're doing Bobby Green right, giving him that red panty night in the main event. He gets the Conor McGregor treatment, taking on Islam Makhachev. Future champ, we'll find out in a big time fight. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
You at home asked for it. The UFC delivered on it. The people wanted to see a Bobby Green main event. They didn't know they wanted it this quick. He's going to be taking on top-ranked Islam Makhachev sitting...
It's like a monkey paw wish. Like, you get what you want, but you're not really getting exactly what you want, you know?
Well, for Bobby Green, he last fought just a couple of weeks ago taking on Nasrat Haqparast. And what he did extremely well in that fight was he negated the power of Haqparast. He was able to establish the distance early and put on one of the most impressive performances of his career. And I can't underscore that because Bobby Green's fought some of the best guys in this division, and he's had some really good fights. I mean, he's got, three fight of the nights? He's got a performance bonus. He's got a submission of the night bonus when those things were a thing. But it's kind of crazy to see the career arc of Bobby Green from down in the doldrums fighting guys that are long forgotten to fighting some of the biggest names, like I said, in this division.
It has been wild. Because he fought Dustin Poirier, Edson Barboza in his initial rise to the top of the division. And maybe rise to the top of the division is a bit of an over-exaggeration, but he was a ranked fighter fighting on pay-per-view main cards. And those are opportunities that aren't afforded to everybody. So it kind of tells you just how important Bobby Green was to this division. But had a few losses to some really, really good fighters. Had some weird bouts of inactivity too, like threatened to retire after a couple weird losses, but he has been able to rekindle himself and really have a nice run as of late. When you're fighting Bobby Green, you remember the show Wipeout with all the different obstacles? You know the wall with all the different boxing gloves? That's what it's like to fight Bobby Green. Every time you try to close the distance, you're constantly getting met by something, whether it's a jab, whether it's a whipping right hand. You're never safe when you're in boxing range with a guy like Bobby Green because he has volume that rarely we see in this division. Now, does he have the best level of power ever? No, he doesn't. He does require a very high level of volume to really start to damage his opponents, but like we've seen in his last two fights, when he can put together one punch and two punch, the effects are devastating. And I even switched my pick from Bobby Green to Nasrat Haqparast on question mark kicks right before the fight happened. I thought, okay, Nasrat's footwork is really going to be able to neutralize some of the boxing of Bobby Green. Boy, was I wrong going into that fight, because What Green did was he made Nasrat pay every time he took a step forward. And every time he took a step forward, it was jab, 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 jab. Whip that head back, whip that head back. Just kept on making his presence felt in the cage. He's going to have to do a very similar style of fighting when he's fighting someone like Islam Makhachev this weekend. Because, listen, Islam's not trying to get on the inside to box with you, no. But he still needs to get on the inside to use his wrestling. And for Green, I really do think that the high level of volume is going to work out really well early on in the fight. But again, this is sort of how I stand this fight. You're probably sick and tired of me saying this, but when you're fighting a wrestler that you know is going to take you down, what's the best thing to do? Let your hands go. Islam Makhachev is going to get Bobby Green down during this fight. A bit of a Skip Bayless hot take by me, I know, but you get the idea. Like, you're fighting one of the best wrestlers we've ever seen in this division, and you're coming in on short notice. You have to expect that at some point you're going to be put in a very, very bad position. If you're Bobby Green, I don't know why you wouldn't just go for broke early on in the fight. Do the Jorge Masvidal, Ben Askren. Go for something wild. Just try to win as fast as you possibly can, because we all know what this fight's going to look like at round 4 and round 5, and it's not going to be pretty for Bobby Green.
No, and that's the thing. I mean, if you have a look at Fight Night picks, we said we're working away at next weekend's UFC Vegas 49, and as a feature every week, we need to know who you've got in the main event. 73% of 892 total votes going with Islam Makhachev, 27% the comeback on Green. DM3 saying Bobby Green is going to get ragdolled. My G, Bobby has a pretty good chance with full camp, and even though he only fought 2 weeks ago, I don't believe the necessary preparation for a guy like Islam. There just aren't many people like him grappling.
I think there's something that has to be said, though. I don't look at the short notice opportunity with Bobby Green as being that big of a detriment to him. Like, Bobby Green is notorious for always being in shape year-round. I know he hasn't always been active. He's flirted with retirement before, but Bobby Green will always be in shape and always have good cardio. Those are some of the few guarantees you can always have going into a Green fight. That's why on short notice, I don't put that much stock into it. I still think we're going to see a relatively 100% Bobby Green going into this weekend. Do you disagree with that, or do you think he'll be about 100%?
I think it'll be about 100%. I mean, it's not like he took a lot of damage in that fight against Nasrat Haqparast. And when you look at Bobby Green's overall game, this is the one thing. Can Islam Makhachev lose? Yeah, he's done it once. I mean, Adriano Moraes cold cocked him just like Jim Miller when he fought Eric Gonzalez. That's my big comp. It's like, whoa, where did that come from? And all of a sudden, Jim Miller's knocking everybody dead. But when it comes to this fight, Bobby Green definitely has that opportunity. He has to establish the distance. Islam Makhachev's a guy that crowds the distance and takes it away with his wrestling. Like, Haqparast struggled because for Haqparast, yeah, he's got to get his footwork moving. He's got to get his hooks to start landing his power to then go to the body and really try and unravel his opponent's game plan. He couldn't do that. And every time he went to throw a power shot or a hook, A, he was either met with a straight shot down the middle, or B, it was Bobby Green's shoulder on the roll. Like, it's you don't often see MMA fighters slipping punches like Bobby Green was able to do. And I know somebody else on the internet that's from DC has talked extensively about Bobby Green slipping punches and how good his boxing is. Obviously, Luke Thomas does a great job at that. So I'll just hammer it home one more time. Bobby Green's one of the premier guys at that. And in this division, a career UFC 72% takedown defense. He got two takedowns against Thiago Moises in a fight that was closer than you might remember. And he was taken down twice in that fight. So that was the last person that took Bobby Green down. Obviously, he had that great third round comeback against Fazeev, ultimately losing that fight by decision. The first round knockout win over Ally Quinta. The decision win that he had just a couple weeks ago against Nasrat Haqparast. Islam Makhachev, though. I mean, Zarukian, Davi Hamo, Drew Dober, Thiago Moises, Dan Hooker. I look at these guys. I mean, Moises included in that, because if you want to play MMA math, one got a win, one got a loss. But Islam Makhachev's ranked fourth in this division. Bobby Green's unranked. Islam Makhachev's looked at as the next Khabib because, again, the similarities, the commonalities of American kickboxing and the lights-out ground game. Like, I just look at Islam Makhachev. Could I see this being a Juliana Pena, Amanda Nunes fight? Maybe. That happened. That really happened.
The difference is, though, Amanda Nunes will play the game of striking and with grappling, and she got overconfident. Islam Makhachev hasn't had the necessary success to then become overconfident yet. I think that's the big difference between these two fighters. And with Islam, like you said it perfectly, he knows what he's good at. And like, that really, really does matter. I know that's a basic thing. Like, of course he knows what he's good at. But with Islam, his striking rate is what it is. Not because he goes in there, boxes with guys for a little bit, then takes them down. His strike rate is what it is because he takes guys down, lands significant strikes from on top, and guys just flail around underneath. Like, I'll be honest, I think Dan Hooker is as good of a fighter as Bobby Green. I know he went back down to featherweight, but like, if those two guys fought, A, it's going to be a fight of the night, and B, it's probably going to be really close. Islam destroyed Dan Hooker and the fight wasn't even close. And Hooker has submission ability of his own. Like, I would say Dan Hooker is the better submission grappler than Bobby Green. Green might be the better wrestler because he has shown the offensive wrestling in his repertoire a little bit more than Hooker. But you get the idea. You have two guys who are very, very good on the feet. Let's call them average on the mat. Maybe that's giving them too much credit and it might not be breaking it down enough. But you get the idea. Two guys who are at least adept on the mat. I just think this fight's going to go very similar to the Dan Hooker fight. For Bobby Green, it's a great opportunity, but this is why I say it's like a monkey paw wish. You're getting the main event slot that you want, but is this really the main event slot that you want? There's just such a weird by the way, and even for Islam, this isn't going to give him the credit that he deserves. Like, if he beat Benil Dariush, yes, Dariush has a few bad losses on his record, but you look at the fighter he's become and the run that he's been on, if you beat Benil Dariush, you're probably fighting for a title in your next fight. If you beat Bobby Green, you probably still need to fight another guy in the top five to really prove yourself worthy of a title shot. And for Islam, it just basically makes him wait another 8 months, because I agree with you, he will fight for a title one day, or at least I think he will. Again, this weekend, big ramifications, of course, but with Islam, it just feels like the timer always gets set back another 6 months, another 8 months. There is an injury. His opponent fell out. There's always an oh, by the way, and it really sucks for a guy who has the ceiling that he does.
And this fight will be contested at a catch weight of 160 pounds. An interesting note, being on incredibly short notice, though, again, I don't worry about Bobby Green making the weight. This guy is a consummate professional. You want to hear a guy rock a mic. Bobby Green, incredibly, incredibly well-spoken, yes. And it's always fun when he gets the opportunity. You look at the odds for this one, Makhachev opened a minus 450. He's a minus 735 average on best fight odds. Bobby Green opened a plus 350. He's a plus 490. And if we have a look at the odds, or the votes rather, on Tapology, 85% Makhachev, 74% by submission. For the 15% that have Green, 72% by knockout. Yeah, for me, I do have Islam Makhachev. Again, you know what you're good at. You're going to go in there. You're going to attempt the takedown. Green has really good takedown defense. I talk about it quite a bit. He's got a different way to defend takedowns than a lot of guys. He just gets a really wide base, presses the head away, circles his way out, and then we're back into boxing. And if you want to see a fun fight in some of the scrambles and the boxing and so on and so forth, there's a couple. I mean, Lando Venata and the Clay Guida fight. Those are fun ones to go back and watch. If you like Bobby Green and you like to see how he's able to get it done, how it's made. How the sausage is made, how the hot dogs are made. I don't like to see how those are made.
What is this?
Disgusting. But there's definitely a path to victory for Bobby Green, and if you like to see that as a positive, so be it. But in this one, Makhachev is so lights out on the ground, so lights out with the takedowns, and I just have to go with him in this one.
Like, if I was on the show, Can You Beat Bobby Flay? I feel like the odds would be very similar. He'd be like a minus 750 over me. Like, I have a chance to throw something nice together, but he's probably going to beat me and it's probably going to be dominant. I like Islam Makhachev in this matchup. He doesn't get hit. I think that's probably an important thing to bring up. Like, he is like Khamzat Chimaev is what I meant to say, with his striking defense. If you're on top in mail, the guy underneath is going to have a really hard time hitting you clean. Makhachev was built to beat guys like Bobby Green. It just is unfortunate, like I've been saying, that he probably won't get the respect he deserves, even if he does have a dominant performance over Green.
We have a big time main event. Bobby Green stepping in on short notice. Do you have him to get the win? Strange things have happened. Adriano Moraes.
It's Martins. I know it's Martins. I screwed up, all right? Come on.
Big time guy way back when. He was able to get the win. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have. We have Fight Night Picks ? Coming up 2 hours before the prelims on the channel. You're going to want to check that one out. Make sure you check out the site too, fightnightpicks.com. All sorts of great content over there. Our own Joshua Hart just doing the damn thing over there. You can find some of the merch on the site and all sorts of other stuff, including the podcast. So find that. Us on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP, at MattAllenFNP, at Fight Night Picks. If you're not subscribed, please do so. Again, those comments help. Those likes help.
They do. Just tell a friend. Share the videos around.
Play that game the whole nine yards. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.